I'm not telling you what I believe. I'm telling you what is taught in the mysteries. I'm telling you what our enemies believe. Make no mistake about it, they are our mortal enemies. They want to see us wiped off the face of the earth. Man huddled in this darkness, fearful, trembling, cold, hungry. And around about he could hear the beasts roaring. And sometimes they were roaring because they were after him. And sometimes he was eaten. A man eventually saw another tree struck by lightning and grabbed that branch with that flame on it. And by a little experimentation, he learned how to keep that fire going. And if he could keep the fire going, he knew something nobody else knew, and he became the first king, the first priest, the first scientist, all rolled into one.
It's Friday. It's 5 o'clock. Welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show on Friday, the 4th of November, 2022. Streaming live from the People's Republic of Stokescroft Arts Centre in Bristol on the talkradio.org.uk stream and at radioqUK.com in Camberley, Surrey. Also live in quite a lot of places these days, aren't we? All sorts of, hopefully this means that it's less easier to shut us down. As Pat Hart, a friend of the Bristol Mayor Marvin Rees, did during COVID, because he didn't like us doing balanced reporting. And live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app, available free from the Apple and all good app stores, not necessarily Google's Play Store. No, try and avoid that one if you can, please. I'm Tony Gosling. Thank you for turning off the psycho in the corner, gaslighting us with its military-grade Ukraine psychological warfare propaganda and continued suppression of some of the COVID jab injuries. Navigating us through the Fourth Reich Matrix, or the World Economic Forum's Fourth Industrial Revolution, it's Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. Joining us in the studio this week, actually, would you like to introduce yourself, Joe, a little?
Yeah. I'm Joe Banks. I'm a freelance writer, and I'm here to talk about maybe some slightly overlooked aspects of Bristol's history.
Great.
And some stuff and that's going on.
Yeah, and you're going to be talking about some, well, you might call breaking news. I don't know if we quite class it as breaking news, yeah. But it's certainly very much more up to date. So in part one, a bit about Ernest Bevin, that is the General Secretary of the Transport and General Workers Union before World War II. Then he became the Minister of Labour in the War Coalition Cabinet. That's the sort of efficient way things used to run in those days. Nowadays, of course, the whole idea of the government seems to be to just ban unions and stop them operating. And also we'll be hearing a bit about St James's Priory, one of Bristol's oldest churches, and its continued links to helping the homeless, and massive high-rises being planned for Bristol city centre, land earmarked for speculators by speculators for decades, and the Friends of Castle Park love it. Why? The Friends of Castle Park love it. Who are they? And also, 12,000 young Albanian men, a loophole apparently means that they can all stay here. They're coming across as so-called asylum seekers. Be interesting to hear what Martin's got to say about that. Also, this week, a migrant camp petrol bomber kills himself. What on earth happened there? Greta Thunberg, bless her, has a new book out. Big friend of Bristol, of course. Diametric opposite to Whitney Webb's The Climate Book. The Climate Book is what it's called, but it's diametrically opposite, I would say, to Whitney Webb's One Nation Under Blackmail, of course. We're having another clip from her as well later. Looking at Extinction Rebellion, I was amazed to see that a lot of their money comes from the Getty Oil family, which is interesting, isn't it? Maybe they're just... They're just seeing the error of their ways. Who knows? And that money going towards these climate protests, such as Just Stop Oil and Insulate Britain, suggesting there might be a kind of astroturf. Anyway, and also Up in Scotland, pretty horrific, but a hearing for 11 accused of satanic child sex ring, the sort of thing that Private Eye spent decades telling us couldn't happen. Chinese social credit system, another one for Martin, as use of police drones with QR codes that you have to scan. And the United States making dodgy strains of COVID. And gain of function continuing in the United States, that ridiculous research which has been proved to be so dangerous. Russians accusing in part two, Russians accusing Liz Truss of messaging Blinken. It's done. 1 minute after the 27th of September's Nord Stream 2 attacks. And last weekend's under and over water drone raid by the Brits, apparently, on Sevastopol in Crimea on the Russian Black Sea fleet. So the Brits seem to be at the front line in this war against Russia, which nobody has actually voted for in this country. And I don't think anyone really wants to have a war with Russia in the UK, apart from the Americans seem to want the Brits to have a war. And Liz Truss apparently was going along with it 100%. UN General Assembly is saying Israel must get rid of its nuclear arsenal. And as I said, Whitney Webb, a look at Palantir this week, the CIA population control software, which for the right price, any corporate can buy it up. So that's another look, as I said, at her book, One Nation Under Blackmail. So the Chinese Communist Party Congress, that finished last week. Really, I don't think we'll be talking that much about that. But there is a brilliant, I think, right at the end of the show, a look at the Freemasons and the Mafia, a fascinating report by Vice magazine. Not quite sure when that was, that report, but anyway, links between the mob and the craft. I think probably just start with a little introduction from you, Joe. Can you just say something about how you got into journalism, a bit about your background?
Well, you mentioned Vice there, and I've written quite a bit for them, interviews and profiles of people and features. I think probably the most interesting thing I did for them was a long piece about Tom McLean, who was the first person to row across the Atlantic Ocean in the 1960s. He was a guy who'd been in the SAS and then rowed from Newfoundland to Ireland with no radio, no GPS or anything like that. So I've written for them, and I've just started writing some stuff for the Bristol Cable. I recently did a piece about a major development that's planned at Western Harbour, and the advisory group that have been put together by the mayor to oversee that was chaired by John Savage, who's an interesting Bristol figure.
Just let me say something about John, because I worked for about 4 or 5 years with John on the board of the Cultural Development Partnership, and he's basically like, he thinks of himself, I think, as the kind of unofficial king of the city, and he was chairing these partnership meetings between the council. Well, it was basically two-thirds government-funded and one-third Business West funded, but this partnership was entirely managed by him. And also other organisations that he funded, such as Business West. You know, so this is really kind of the Chamber of Commerce lording it over the politicians and telling them what the priorities are. Whatever's good for business, I'm reminded of that expression: whatever's good for General Motors is good for America. Well, I mean, you know, that's let General Motors run, have a seat in the White House and run the show from there. That's John's attitude, I'm afraid. But just what about, you know, a bit more on you for a second, Joe. Not, I don't want to, you know, sort of grill you too much, but what drew you to journalism?
I like going and meeting people or going into situations and just trying to understand what's going on. I think that's the main draw, then trying to put that into words.
It's a challenge, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's a hell of a challenge sometimes.
Yeah.
If you've come to understand a situation, you've got to know a situation, and actually then to articulate it Anyway, shall we start while you're, you know, just taking us a bit through this? Born in Somerset, he was, I'm guessing, sort of end of the 1900s. Must have been, mustn't it?
Well, 1881. He's born in Winsford on Exmoor. Just
this is Ernie Bevan, by the way, for the audience's sake.
Yes, we're on to Ernie Bevan. Yeah.
Just making sure that the audience know who we're talking about.
Sorry, Joe, but before we start, Martin, can you just say something about that kind of era of the Labour Party?
Well, not the 1880s, because that's when he was born, and the Labour Party didn't exist.
No, I'm talking about the Ernest Bevan era in the Labour Party.
Well, it was, I mean, before World War One, he was a militant on the docks here in Bristol.
Mm. That was his entry into trade unionism.
Into trade unionism. And in the actual fact, in 2014, Bristol Radical History Group did a reenactment of the debate that was held on the docks in 1914 about the war and whether Britain should go to war. And he was the one who argued that Britain shouldn't go to war. And he argued against the First World War as a young militant on the docks down in the centre of Bristol.
Okay, well, I think we'll leave that. I don't know if you... I just wanted you to talk a little bit about what the Labour Party was up to.
Well, I'm talking about the Labour Party in that era was a very small party. It was a minor party.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Okay. So back to you, Joe.
Yeah. I mean, It's a fascinating... I find Bevan's story inspiring on a sort of individual level of a story of a human being. So I think it's very interesting to look at how he started. So he was born into rural poverty on Exmoor, never knew his father. His mother died when he was 8. He leaves primary school at 11. Leaves education at 11 and becomes a farm labourer, and then comes to Bristol when he's 13 in 1894, because his brothers have come up to Bristol, and is then working through his teenage years, working in restaurants. He works in a bakehouse on St Augustine's Parade, and then he gets a job. Delivering mineral water all around Bristol on a horse and cart. And that's when he's 19. And actually, just the firm that he worked for was yards from where we're sat right now, in St Paul's. And then he's in this very, really interesting, dynamic, early 20th century Bristol world of nonconformist religion. He's a Baptist. Of Sunday school, lay preaching, big debating sessions on Sunday afternoons on Old King Street, which is now in Broadmead, he joins the Bristol Socialist Society, It's this combination of religion and socialism, and then his major step into the sort of civic life of Bristol is when he's made secretary of the Bristol Right to Work Committee in 1908, which is a time of serious unemployment. I think the worst unemployment in the country since 1886. And he's doing things like going in to see the Lord Mayor with a group of unemployed men, trying to get work projects going. One of them is the lake that's dug in Eastfield Park, which is now called, some people call it Bevan's Lake. He does another thing around this time where he takes 400 unemployed men into Bristol Cathedral on a Sunday morning, and they go in a kind of procession into the cathedral, and it's a very powerful public protest just down the and then he stands as a councillor in St Paul's. He stands as a socialist against a liberal businessman, and it's a very nasty sort of bitter campaign. He's abused. People people come up and take the mickey out of him because he has a horse and cart. And he's very disillusioned. He loses that. The Liberal wins the St Paul's seat, the ward, and he loses a lot of business in Bristol. He's frozen out by a lot of the businesses that he delivers to, the hotels and places like this. And he for a while he thinks about leaving and becoming a missionary. But he sort of, and then he kind of drops out of all his political activity. But then there's a strike on the Bristol docks in 1910, the summer of 1910. And he puts together a kind of relief fund for the striking dockers. And then that leads to him starting a Carter's branch of the Dockers Union. And that's where his trade unionism activity starts.
So, I mean, one of the most interesting parts, from my point of view, looking at this, as myself, I suppose you call me a Christian socialist, is this whole idea of debating in the street.
Yeah.
You know, having these debates. The church doesn't get involved in really anything, so far as I can see, in the city like this. And it used to kind of, if you go back as far as the 1990s, there were some sort of similar types of things. But, I mean, what were these street debates like? I mean, was it just people after they come out of church or something?
Yeah. That would happen, you know, people getting up on soapboxes and mass meetings, you know, hundreds and hundreds of people on a Sunday afternoon or even, you know, very early on a Sunday morning before church, this is going on. And it's a totally... I find it incredibly striking what a different world it is. And it's because it's an environment that can give someone from a background like Bevan, that's where he learns to articulate himself and debate. And it's evening classes as well. It's the adult education movement that's starting then. Classes at the YMCA in St James's Square, which was just around the corner from here. So it's that, you know, it's that that is a vanished world.
Yeah, it's also, it's interesting how, I mean, there is this kind of egalitarian side to it, isn't it, where pretty much anybody can just get up on their soapbox. And nowadays, of course, that kind of route to the public ear, if you want, is gatekept effectively by the media. You know, they're saying, well, no, not everyone can do that. You know, you can't just stroll in to the BBC and get on the, you know. And I can remember talking to people about the early days of BBC local radio, because that's how they envisaged it. They envisaged it as a sort of pretty much like almost like an open studio type thing where people can just kind of come up there, sit down in front of a microphone like we're doing now. And they saw that as a kind of levelling influence. And, of course, it's become something completely different now, which is actually very closely gatekept again. You can probably get on the airwaves by... I suppose that's the equivalent, isn't it, Joe, that you can actually pick up the phone and phone in now and get on the airwaves. Pretty much anyone can do that.
Yeah, but, I mean, but it's all so individualised and atomised. And, you know, it's social media as well. That's Twitter, and that's where the debate's gone.
Unless you get cancelled there, of course.
Right, yeah.
But anyway, so look, how did Bevan then get into national politics from getting involved in the unions here? I don't want to skip over too much.
No, well, he becomes, by 1914, he becomes a national organiser for the Dockers Union. And then he comes to national prominence in the media, and I think it's just after the war he becomes known as the Dockers KC, because he there's a famous case at the Royal Courts of Justice where he represented the workers himself in court and made a kind of dramatic spectacle of bringing out into court exactly what a docker was supposed to live on, you know, supposed to eat a day on the wages that they were on. And then, you know, but very not long after that, he founds the Transport and General Workers Union in 1922. And then he's General Secretary all the way through, you know, becomes one of the leading figures in the labour movement. And he's doing that all the way through to the war when he enters Churchill's cabinet.
Well, I mean, I find this an amazing kind of rise there, but also, I mean, you know, to run, well, I imagine what with the Transport in General, certainly after the war, was the biggest union in the country for a while. I mean, I don't know how long for, but to go from being a General Secretary elected to run a union to then an MP elected and actually sitting in the war cabinet in charge of that role just shows, I think, the difference in politics now. You know, I mean, obviously that was wartime. I suppose some would say we're in wartime now, you know, especially with some of the stories this week about the Royal Navy's involvement in attacks on Sevastopol and on the Nord Stream 2, as alleged by the Russians. But, you know, this idea of going from, you know, the top union leader into the cabinet just shows something about the, you know, the wartime coalition that was put together.
I think there's an argument that to be made that without Bevin, there's no. It makes it much less likely that there's a Labour government after the war that's able to come in with the bold programme of reform that it did. And another thing is that he was key to Attlee becoming leader in 1935. By basically finishing off George Lansbury at the party conference over Mussolini's invasion of Abyssinia, and then he and Attlee are staunch all the way through, and the most vital thing is in his role as Minister of Labour, you've got the Labour Party right at the centre of the national struggle for survival, and that, you know, that's key to their election success in 45.
Yeah, and it was pretty striking, that, wasn't it, Martin?
Yes, it was, and there's a comparison to be made with the other Bevan from South Wales, because he, of course, started off as a miner. And he was originally an anarchist. He was involved in something called the Miners' Next Step, which was an anarcho-syndicalist organisation. So they until the general strike. And after the general strike, he realised that, you know, we're not going to have a syndicalist revolution where the workers are just going to seize power. And so he decided he'd have to get elected as a local councillor, which he did. And then he realised that local councillors don't decide anything, so I'll have to be an MP. Then he did. And he crawled his way up that way. So they're both called Bevan, but spelt differently. Mm. But they were both in that cabinet that put together the proposal, the National Health Service and all the rest of it, which was the...
But it wasn't exactly a ringing endorsement of Winston Churchill, was it, in 1945?
No, it wasn't.
Joe?
No, but there was a sense that the country had to be rebuilt. I think the Labour Party had that added legitimacy, you know, had got round all the forces within the country that were that were out to, you know, see off any kind of left wing government.
Well, this is a tale of the rise of the Labour Party. I think it's fair to say, I mean, the Labour Party was also very strong in the 1930s with the unemployed movement. There was an enormous thing like these mass marches of unemployed people saying, look, you know, we actually do, you know, after the Wall Street crash 1929, right the way through the 30s, there were workers who were just completely and utterly destitute, living in slums if they were actually had a roof over their heads. And so this was a powerful, you know, build up to, number one, to the war, because of course it meant that there were quite a lot of people that needed work when the war came along. It was almost like a godsend, you know, okay, put a uniform on or else go into a wartime factory. And so this really was about how the Labour Party was formed, you know, out of this this just desperate need and desperate poverty. And I suppose there were millions across the country that formed part of that. And of course, around about that time was also when George Orwell was writing his books like The Road to Wigan Pier, looking at exactly what was going on in the country, really carefully examining this whole social situation. So it was what I'm saying, I suppose, is that electoral victory in 1945 and previous electoral victories by the Labour Party were backed by a really deep understanding of how society operates, Joe.
I mean, a lot of that is rooted in the organising work of the trade union movement, and that was Bevin's huge skill, was in organising, and the fact that you had to draw together these disparate elements in the labour movement, and that's why his thing was always to amalgamate and organise. But I find it, you know, one of the reasons I want to talk about it is because I find it extraordinary that Bristol, you know, seems to have totally forgotten about him. There's a very small plaque where he lived in St. Werburgh's, but there are no streets named after him or statues or. A piece in the Bristol Post a couple of years ago that was a list of 75 legends of Bristol, and he didn't feature in that at all, which I found incredible.
Well, isn't it amazing? I mean, I suppose this is because it's easy, we can guess. It's because the elite of the city, which includes, I suppose, the owners of the various media and the runners of the city, the people behind the scenes, the merchant venturers, see that whole movement as actually quite a threat. So, I mean, this is also, isn't it, Martin, in the context of getting rid of the Colston statue, it's almost as if what Joe's saying here, and even like almost like the bricks of the city are screaming, what about a statue to Ernie Bevin?
Well, I think one of the problems with that, one of the things that may have led to people not regarding him in the same way as they regard, for example, Nye Bevin on the left, is because Bevin became the Foreign Secretary. Mm-hmm. And, of course, he then decided to get Britain the nuclear bomb. So he was very much one of the people who said, we want one of those and we want a great big Union Jack on top of it. And he very much took the view that, you know, we had to... You know, that what you might call the right wing of the Labour Party wrapping themselves in the flag sort of view. And of course, on the left, that was never really regarded as a particular, I mean, Nye Bevin also decided that he was going to go with that trend. But of course, the anti-nuclear movement in the 50s and so on, they didn't really like that at all. And there were big fights at the Labour Party conference floor on exactly these issues. So they both really, because Nye Bevin, of course, created the health service, which is impossible to ignore. Yeah. It's just there. Yeah. You know, and everybody knows that he made it. Whereas Bevin's role has become more, with the passage of time, has seemed more ambiguous. And I'll bet you loads more people have heard of Nye Bevin than have heard of Ernie Bevin.
Yeah, whenever you mention it,
people think it's the wrong one.
Yes, But also, you know, a sort of a negative thing with Ernest was the fact that he was wedded to the British Empire.
Yeah.
You know, as Foreign Secretary. And didn't see that it was all coming to an end.
True,
yeah, but it's not just Nye eclipsing Ernest, is it? It's also the fact that Ernest represents a side of history that certain powerful people would rather forget about.
Well, that's true as well, Tony. This is just a bit more nuance in it, in terms of how he's remembered. Of course, the people, you know, the old guard in the city and the old guard in the country regard both of them as a threat. But there's no doubt about it.
But I mean, yeah, it's extraordinary that the city would have that statue of Colston up until a couple of years ago and have no memorial to Ernest Bevin.
Well, let's see what we can do.
Yeah, maybe the campaign starts here.
Well, absolutely. Why not? But anyway, let's just because I know you've done some fantastic historical digging over the years, Admirable stuff. And what is this St. James Priory? I know if you come out of Bristol's bus station and you go past the some place where you can get a snack, I suppose, in Kew and pay too much for it or whatever, but and then sit in a park. There's a park right by the bus station in central Bristol with St. James's Priory sitting in it.
That's it. You just turn the corner, it's hidden, it's sort of tucked away behind the bus station. This is a place that I wrote a piece for the Bristol Cable about, mainly about what they've been doing there in the last couple of decades. But it led me into this through a sort of incredible portal into the world that it came out of. So it's a 12th century prior. It's the oldest building in use in Bristol. It was founded in 1129 by the guy who built Bristol Castle, who was Robert Earl of Gloucester, who was the grandson of William the Conqueror, the eldest illegitimate son of Henry I, and one of the wealthiest barons of the Anglo-Norman world. And he plays a, you know, arguably he plays a, and Bristol plays a key role in British history at that point, because without his role in the anarchy, which was the big civil war in the 12th century between Matilda and Stephen, he was Matilda's great ally and big backer, big military and financial backer, and ultimately her son becomes Henry II, and that's the start of the Plantagenet dynasty that lasts for over 300 years on the English throne through to the Tudors. But you can just walk out of the bus station, round the corner, go into this 12th century church, which has been restored about a big conservation project about 10 years ago. And you're back in this world. And he was also a big literary patron. So he was patron to probably the two most important chroniclers of the High Middle Ages, Geoffrey of Monmouth and William of Malmesbury. And their books are dedicated to him.
They probably paint a fantastic view of his role in history, do they?
Well, yeah, the dedications do, of course, yeah. But with Geoffrey of Monmouth, that's the creation of the Arthurian legend in his history of the kings of Britain, and William of Malmesbury is seen as the leading historical scholar of his time, probably since Bede, whereas Geoffrey of Monmouth was a kind of mythographer who he went back to the books, the Welsh books, and created these myths and legends.
Right, but I mean, to what extent was that actually kind of myth posing as history then?
Well, what with Arthur?
Well, yeah, I mean, it doesn't sound. I mean, most historians now look at Arthur as just a pure myth, don't they? And I wonder, was he trying to present this as factual? Because in those days, of course, it was considered quite kind of, I suppose, normal to commission yourself somebody to rewrite history for you. I mean, obviously, there's a similar sort of thing going on today, but it was a lot easier to do in medieval times when so few people had access to knowledge and literature.
Yeah, well, Geoffrey of Monmouth's, you know, history was a lot more popular because it was a lot more exciting.
it was the Hollywood version.
Yeah. But it's lasted, you know, God, I mean, it's lasted, isn't it?
Well, it certainly has. I mean, it was interesting when I was down in Glastonbury interviewing people down there for the old dialect show. They were kind of looking slightly uncomfortable. Yes, well, for many years, people kind of came here to, I think it wasn't it, oh God, is it Arthur's tomb or something? Mm. And it was just nonsense. And, well, they think nowadays that it was just sort of put there as a way to lure people, rather like.
They did the same at Glastonbury. Yeah, the monks there conveniently discovered Arthur's bones in the Abbey.
But the fact that people believed all of these things for hundreds of years is in itself historical fact.
Yeah.
And it basically led to things happening. I mean, Geoffrey of Monmouth took these Welsh legends and they made them popular amongst the sort of French-speaking aristocracy, because it meant that they could identify with Arthur, who was older than the English. Yeah, because they and therefore the politics of it was an attempt to try and indigenize the Norman conquest by using Celtic myth, which of course is, you know, the and all of this stuff is still being carried through in our monarchy today. I mean, it's not disappeared. It's all there in these various layers, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, that's right. I mean, we've got this whole situation with apparently a lot of Welsh people thinking, well, we don't really want to have a Prince of Wales, thank you very much.
The whole idea of the Prince of Wales was Edward I imposed his son, Edward II, instead of Llewellyn, was it Llewellyn who was the last one?
I don't know.
Yeah, I think Llewellyn was the last Prince of Wales, and he was put down by Edward I, and therefore he made sure that his son, Edward II, was born in his, you know, evil castle of Carnarvon. Therefore that Prince of Wales, and if you go to talk to really strong Welsh nationalist people and you call Wales the Principality, they get very offended. It's not a principality, it's a nation.
Well, let's come back to St James's Priory, because I think it's interesting to see how that's evolved over the years. Yes, I mean, how open and accessible is it? Can you just wander in there like you can to some city centre churches?
It seems to be less open than it was. This is maybe a bit of a hangover from COVID. But you can. Look on the website. It's open. It has been open for 3 hours in the afternoon most days, or something like that. It's a very beautiful, it's an incredible little oasis in right in the heart of the city.
Because traditionally these churches were open. I know certainly that St Mary on the Quay is almost always open, which is the Catholic church, although it's not actually on the quay anymore because the quay has moved. But I mean, this is another problem, I suppose, with churches, is that because of the fall of the church, the slow decline, there aren't the personnel to actually make sure there's someone around, and that the city centre churches can get vandalised, so they often tend to be closed. So, what's the priory being used for these days?
Yeah, well, so, I mean, St James's Priory fell into it became derelict in the 1980s and was just left, shut up and left.
There are quite a few churches.
The roof was falling in, you know, it was leaking.
Yeah, there are quite a few churches in the city actually right now like that. Yeah. So, you know, I'm thinking of, I think it's on St Michael's Hill, St Michael's just boarded up. You know, there's one actually just on the edge of Queen's Square near the Arnolfini, all been boarded up for decades, you know, so... But St James's Priory, there was a sort of new lease of life.
Yes, it was taken over by... There were three monks who came down from a religious community in Scotland down to Bristol in the 80s with a mission to help the homeless of the city. And they were working out of a church in Easton. And then the Church of England diocese said, we've got this abandoned, empty church in the centre of the city. Would you like to use it, have it as a base? And so then they were opening it up for... drop-ins and offering food and somewhere for homeless people to come. And then there's a lady called Susan Jotram who got involved, and they started to develop the whole thing and decided they wanted to build on the site. They wanted to build a residential rehab for people with drug and alcohol addictions, in order to, you know, get at the root problems with the people that they were, who were coming in, and so that was built. That you can see that by the little park that's there, and then they bought an adjoining property, and that became a sheltered accommodation for people in recovery from drug and alcohol addictions. And then she got the money. She's just sort of tirelessly working away, decade after decade. Getting these sort of grants and getting money out of people, and then got money from the National Lottery to do a big restoration project of the church and deal with all those structural problems that had been an issue. But sadly, and the thing that I wrote about really was that the residential rehab had to close down in 2012, largely due to the fact that the government, you know, with austerity cuts, cut off the funding for it. And now there are no, as far as I understand it, there are no, you know, free to use residential rehabs in Bristol left. I think there were about six, about 15 years ago. Now there are none.
Well, this is, I suppose, the wider picture here is we have to sort of scratch our heads sometimes and wonder what we're paying tax for. I mean, surely this is the whole point of a government, is that they are able to provide things that cannot be provided commercially. And it seems to me, and maybe I can bring you in here, Martin, that certainly since 2010 and the, you know, the structural dismantling of the finances coming into local government, government has become something that, you know, collects money, but it's difficult to see, other than something like bin collections, what they're actually doing with it.
Well, I mean, the austerity, there's a recent report from Glasgow University that's come out, which tries to estimate the excess deaths in the population since as a result of austerity. And it's pretty shocking stuff, you can imagine. I mean, if you close all the residential rehab in a city like Bristol, which has always been a druggy place, you're asking for people to die, aren't you?
Yeah,
and, of course, they do. And then, of course, they go into the stats as... I mean, during that Osborne era, life expectancy in Britain has been gradually going up for a very long time, but it started to go down for the first time in over a century, and that is George Osborne. And, of course, the real bottom line of this is he didn't actually get the deficit down and he lost the country's AAA credit rating. So coming back to what's happening this week, the decision by the Bank of England to raise interest rates and by the Chancellor, no doubt, on the 17th to cut public expenditure will not bring the deficit down and will push us over the edge. It's absolutely bonkers, but they're going to do it.
So, Joe, what's happening there now? Is it just literally kind of mothballed accommodation?
It's as far as I understand, it's now Catholic students it's sort of a residential thing for them.
They're actually renting it out or something?
Yes. Actually, after that, it was run by St Mungo's, who were using it as a mental health crisis centre. So they were there, St Mungo's were there for about 10 years, but they've recently gone. I don't know why. And now it's being used for students.
Anyway, this brings us up to date. I mean, it's a tragic story, you know, in that, you know, it seems to me, Joe, that this is about, you know, you know, lives completely abandoned, people who are just kind of left on the scrap heap, and that society... at least local government and central government see these people as just superfluous, like almost like kind of rubbish.
Yeah, well, there seems to be no joined up approach to deal with it.
Well, no morality, no heart either. But what about this more sort of, I suppose, politically edged story, which is that you've been looking at recently to do with Castle Park? This is, of course, the same castle we were talking about earlier.
Yeah.
Which was flattened, wasn't it, I think, around the time of after the English Civil War?
The castle was pulled down then, yeah. What remained of it was pulled down then.
Yeah, and ever since, I mean, actually, there was a lot of bombing of that area of the city to the west side of Castle Park in World War Two.
Yeah.
Then there was a kind of, afterwards, the Bank of England, I think probably in the 50s and 60s, looking at the architecture, built the West of England kind of Bristol centre of the Bank of England, which you can still see. It's got a kind of pillbox there, almost like, so you can check to make sure that the bank is not going to get attacked by bank robbers or something as the vans go in and out. And it was a counter, Bank of England counter of some sort, because you can still peep through the windows and see the old cashiers. And in fact, that building has been used by pop-up pubs, I think, over the last few years, even though it's been empty and derelict. Then next to it was a building owned by Lloyd's, which was this notorious business support unit, which was destroying people, basically taking. There was a whole signature forgery scandal associated with that. We've dealt with several stories of that over the years, and that, of course, as soon as we got a new police and crime commissioner last year, that the business support unit moved immediately out because there were allegations that they had connections within the local Avon and Somerset Constabulary that meant that they, you know, felt that they wouldn't be investigated for any kind of crimes that they were committing. And the Norwich Union building was many decades ago closed down. So initially it was bombed in the war. It was kind of rebuilt. And then that whole area on the east of the Castle Park is now completely derelict. But there are plans for it, aren't there?
Yes. So, as you said, yeah, going back, it was that was Castle Park was the commercial heart of Bristol, where shops and hotels and pubs and this network of little alleys and roads, streets, which was most of it was flattened in the Bristol Blitz and then demolished, and then you had these 1960s buildings built, and it's so it was recently that the leaseholds, the three buildings, were bought up by Federated Hermes, which is a global investment manager, enormous, yeah, and based in the US, which has global assets of about $670 billion. And they do a lot of work with the BT pension scheme as the investor, and they build a lot of business parks and science parks and this sort of thing. And they've put together a scheme to build three huge office blocks with some mixed use shops and cafes on the ground floor, and that was passed by a tight sort of close 5-3 vote at a planning committee, Bristol City Council planning committee, in December last year. And
it was a controversial decision, I would say very controversial decision, particularly because it's so high rise. I think at the time, yes, I'm sure at the time, I interviewed, in fact, we may have even had him here sitting in the studio, the former Mayor George Ferguson, the architect.
Yes, he was very outspoken about it.
To discuss how absolutely appalled he was. So what's wrong? I mean, something's got to happen there, hasn't it? What's wrong with this?
Well, I mean, what I discovered was that, I mean, I think there are quite a lot of things that are wrong with it, but one aspect of it was that the developers' community engagement was all based around this community group called Friends of Castle Park, and I discovered that this was essentially a Facebook group that was started in 2018, and it has no formal structure, no minuted meetings, no AGM,
yeah,
no constitution.
It's useful to point out, Joe, that this whole aspect of community engagement is an important part these days of these controversial planning decisions. Is that the speculators have got to show, yes, we've engaged with the community and they support us. But what you're suggesting is that this is something that sort of popped up out of nowhere and isn't really very accountable. So, yeah, so who are these people? What are they saying? And who do they represent?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, it was... So you had somebody set it up who was... doing good stuff in the park, organising litter picking and stuff like this, but very, very strongly in favour of the development, and was clearly in communication with the developer before it even became public, before they even publicly announced that they were developing the site. Conversations had been going on with this person who had set up the Facebook group without any members of the Facebook group knowing about it, I think the most worrying thing about sort of in terms of the planning system is that you have the councillors who are voting on the application in the meeting, being repeatedly told about the support for the development from this community group, Friends of Castle Park. That's coming from the developer, actually, in their statement to the councillors. You know, a short statement that has to be delivered in a minute. They mentioned Friends of Castle Park three times. The statement from the self-appointed spokespersons of Friends of Castle Park, you know, gave demonstrably false statements about the support of the group for the development, because the group had never been asked about it. There's a big question of democratic accountability, I think. And then you have the councillors who are actually voting on the application, citing the support of this group in determining their vote. And that's all on record. You can see that online.
God. I mean, you know, it just sounds to me as if the speculators have picked a person, maybe a small team, met with them, and basically, I mean, this is actually rather similar to the way that the Mayor Marvin Rees operates. It's basically hand-picked people that are then said to represent the community and involved in all sorts of very important decisions. The only thing is that they are, they're hand-picked. They're not grassroots in any way. They're not really connected in any way with the community. And I've noticed on this Friends of Castle Park group that they are actually, what they're doing is they're quite subtly undermining other much more fairly constituted groups in the city, like, the for example, the Trees Forum, things like that. They're saying, well, what about all the trees that are being cut down? They're saying, well, what are you trying to do? Stand in the way of the development? Well, hang on. And we see other people weighing in there. I mean, it's been quite an interesting. I just had a look at the group yesterday, and it's actually, the discussion is quite, it's quite obvious that the people that administer that group want to shut down any kind of criticism whatsoever of the development.
Well, this happened to me exactly, because I actually wrote a statement, outlining my concerns about the role that it had played in the planning process, posted that up to the group, and it was immediately taken down by the admins.
Oh, interesting. Well, it sounds to me like a marketing exercise rather than a community group.
Yeah. Well, it's. I mean, if you're going to stand there and say I'm a spokesperson for 1,300 people, you know, that's how many members there were in the Facebook group. You have to have some accountability. You can't just appoint yourself to that. Either you have a formal structure in a community group that delegates authority to you. You know, you're voted as a chair of something, or you go directly to the members and get a vote on it.
Well, so for something which is going to change the face of the city potentially so massively, at the crucial, I mean, you know, Bristol Bridge and Castle Park, which is where we're talking about here.
And it's the origins of the city.
Well, that's right. It's why the city is here. You know, it's really is the very centre of the city. What's going on? I mean, is there been any reporting on this? Have you managed to get any articles out or whatever?
There will be. There should be a piece in the Bristol Cable next week. Hopefully. There was a very misleading, this person who started the Facebook group and who gave those misleading statements to the councillors. He had a piece in the the other thing is that he had repeated these falsehoods in the local media, as had the developer, all the way through this planning process. It was in Bristol 24/7. It was in the BBC. He wrote a piece in February this year, saying that the members of the group supported this development 10-1, which was a completely baseless claim based on him counting emoji reactions to posts in the Facebook group.
Yeah, some of which, of course, he had deleted, which ones he didn't like,
and they were from people who who didn't know that there, I mean, I think there's a data protection issue there as well, actually, but people who didn't know that, you know, what they were doing was being counted as a vote for or against this particular development. I mean, it was completely nonsensical. But there has been a piece this week where he was interviewed in Bristol 24/7, and he was talking about being trolled. This was a clear attempt by him to control that narrative, because there is, there is a piece that's going to lay out the facts that's coming out quite soon.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. I mean, this is the ultimate question, though: is this massive high rise development that everybody seems to think is just so ridiculously over the top and completely out of keeping? I mean, there were even suggestions that George Ferguson was saying that what would happen in most European cities is that there would be a little look at some of the old photographs of the types of old buildings that were bombed during the Second World War, and a planning application that came along looking to, you know, in some way, obviously you can't rebuild them, but to do something which was in keeping with the traditional city that was the part of the city that was bombed, would be looked on more favourably by the planners. Mm. And that, you know, is there any chance of that, or is this hideous, you know, square? Well,
they've almost done a pastiche of that, because you had at the corner there of Wine Street and High Street, you had the Dutch House, which was this iconic building that was destroyed in the Bristol Blitz, which had floors that went out as the building went up, and they've copied that style, but for a much you know, vastly mass, bigger building, and in a way that's, you know, it seems to me just to be a naked attempt to maximise office floor space. Mm.
So is it going to happen, do you think, this
well, it looks at the moment, because there was a request from the Civic Society back in January to for the government to call it in. That there was an answer that finally came back last month from the Secretary of State, saying that who was one of these Secretaries of State who was there for about 3 weeks recently and came back saying that the decision should be made locally. So the original decision from the planning committee stands, and so it looks like, yeah, it will go ahead.
Oh, how horrific. I mean, this, it does seem as if this is one of the things that's happening with the marvellous Marvin the Mayor, even though he's on his way out, because people voted to actually completely get rid of his position of mayor and go back to the old committee system. So they saw it as too easy for the lobbyists to sort of get hold of him, get things done that they wanted to be done, make lots of money in the city, do these kind of speculative developments. And his attitude seems to be, well, it is. He says it again and again. He likes to see cranes on the horizon. That's all he's interested in, really. He wants more cranes.
The means seem to justify the ends. And if you're on side, you know, you're on the team.
Yeah, it's a bit of a clique, and the idea is that this is the last chance that all the speculators have got to get their dream developments through, with very little pushback from the city, because the mayor is basically on their side, and that's happening before us. So anyway, it's interesting, very interesting that you've dug out all this. Do you have your own blog or something, Joe?
I've got a website with my my articles on.
Which is
joe-banks.com.
Okay. Well, anyway, let's go on to look at some of the other news. That's absolutely brilliant, you know, sort of summary and a bit of dig into history there.
That was very enjoyable. Thank you.
Some of the other stories going on this week. And I suppose on a similar line, is this revelation about, I think it was in the Telegraph, about Getty oil money being behind Extinction Rebellion franchise campaigns, including Extinction Rebellion itself. You know, this is, we actually did an excerpt from a podcast from, I think it was from the 1990s, a few weeks ago, which was saying that in the United States that the big energy companies were recruiting, having meetings with these sort of Greenpeace groups and things like that to try and actually start protests back then, and to kind of try and co-opt this kind of AstroTurf attitude to environmental campaigning back in those days. But Martin, what do you make of this? Just Stop Oil, Insulate Britain, funded by Getty Oil money.
Well, I think the oil industry hedges its bets, and it decides to for many years there's evidence to show that they knew the potential for global warming, but they went out of their way to suppress it, as the tobacco industry did with tobacco. But once the mood changes and the wind changes direction, they want to control the outcomes. And don't forget, if we actually reduce oil and gas consumption, that's not necessarily bad for the profits of oil companies, is it, if you think about it?
Joe?
I don't know if I have anything massively interesting to say about that.
Well, that's an honest answer.
Sorry.
No, that's fine, because there's no reason why everybody should be an expert on everything. We're just chatting away.
That's fine.
Yeah, I mean, personally, it looks to me as if this is the reason I'm bringing this story up first is because there's a kind of contrast with what's been going on, it seems, in Castle Park, where the industry feels that as we get more and more austerity, people have got less and less spare time. They can, in fact, direct and steer the campaigns against them, almost like a kind of controlled opposition. I'm just trying to dig the article up. I think actually it might have been the Times rather than the Telegraph. Pretty devastating, really. I mean, if you think that the environmentalists, people who are going out and sort of gluing themselves to roads and whatever, throwing, paint at paintings in galleries just to try and get attention, even though it really doesn't relate to their campaign at all, that this is all potentially funded by oil money. I just find it almost unbelievable and shocking that there's not really been more publicity for this. And maybe if you can say a bit more about it, Martin, while I dig out the actual name of the woman from the Getty family that's funding this.
Yeah, okay. Well, you can see that some of these protests are in actual fact alienating people from the goals of the protesters. And if you were the oil industry, that might be a very useful tactic to pursue. They want to control opposition to what they do. And as I said earlier, it may be that they're not that unhappy about reducing oil and gas consumption as long as they're still in control of oil and gas. There's a lot of money to be made there, as we can see of what's happened in the Ukraine and so on. That this has not been at all unfortunate for the Western oil companies and gas companies. They're doing rather well out of the war. And in any case, they always want to control their opposition. We have what you might call state spying, you know, the special demonstration squad, the spy cops. But corporations carry out spying as well, independently, often operating in tandem with the state. And, an awful lot of what you see is theatre of one kind and another to steer public opinion in various directions. That doesn't mean that people involved in these protest movements are all tools. Many of them are genuine, but you can be a genuine person in a manipulated movement. And as a member of the Labour Party, I think that's a fairly straightforward thing to people to understand. And the same with anything else you're involved in. I haven't seen the article in the Telegraph, Tony.
Well, anyway, look, Martin, can I just stop a second? The heiress of the billionaire Getty Oil dynasty has donated $1 million to Just Stop Oil. Outrages foreign millionaire bankrolls eco mob, says Times, disrupting lives of hard-working Britons. Aileen Getty has given more than £800,000 of her own money to fund.
Well, that's not the oil industry, is it?
No, I never did say it was, but obviously she's part of it.
Her money comes from the oil industry, but she may be one of those people that feels terribly shamed by the fact that her family made their money from the oil industry and now wants to make amends.
She's the granddaughter of American oil tycoon J. Paul Getty, who was once named the world's richest man. Money has gone to the Climate Emergency Fund, which has given grants to eco-zealots, they say. Just stop oil. Supporters cause chaos by blocking roads, blah, blah. But, I mean, I just think that's an interesting way that, I suppose you could, yeah, you could say this is... yeah, it could be either, couldn't it?
Well, it is what it is. It's not corporate, is what I'm the point I'd make.
No.
Correct. So, in other words, this is a wealthy person just, you know, spending their money on what they think they want to spend it on.
I'd just like to get Joe's view on this whole sort of, these environmental, so-called environmental campaigns. I mean, as an environmentalist, I see many of them as counterproductive, really, in that they're not really going for the traditional targets of campaigns, that is things like AGMs and the actual perpetrators. They're just going to sort of, the idea is to draw attention to the campaign by getting in the street and
stopping
everything.
Yeah, I agree with that. I agree. I think it is a problem that if we're living in a permanent state of spectacle, these unending spectacles, daily spectacles, it becomes meaningless. It's another thing to be consumed alone. Again, it, I mean, to go back to the world that made Ernest Bevin, I don't see it as something that builds solidarity among people.
No. Anyway, I mean, I just, you know, the whole point, surely, of a campaign is to target the people responsible, not the people who are the victims. You know, this just seems to me, you know, something ridiculously kind of counterintuitive and ridiculous about that. Also, we hear this week about Greta Thunberg and her new book out, which is called The Climate Book. This also draws a certain amount of criticism, but Joe, what do you make of this whole debate, the whole discussion about the extent to which climate change is, you know, is Britain's responsibility to do something about, or is it China's, and also to what extent is it man-made?
God.
That's a nice, easy low ball, isn't it? Yeah.
I know, it's a biggie, but I mean, you know, this is the sort of debate. I mean, I've been having conversations with people over here about that, and you know, you get the idea that the really big thrashing these issues out debates, public debates, haven't happened. We did one on the show, I think it may have been the Dialect show, which we excerpted on the main show a few years ago, between Joe House at Bristol University, the Department of Climate Science, and Piers Corbyn about this. But it was a real hour-long thrashed-out debate. Is climate change really man-made? Now, it doesn't seem to me as if that debate is being allowed to continue. Somebody somewhere from on high has said, well, it is all man-made, and we're not allowed to discuss this anymore. The science says it's man-made, and there's no discussion.
Yeah, no, I agree. The nuance gets thrown out, and people go into camps, and... you know, things become ideologically pure, like net zero. You know, it becomes sort of unacceptable to even question the premise of that.
We've discussed this whole thing of scientism quite a bit on this show. It's almost like becoming like a religion. You know, when you're not allowed to discuss stuff. Because I remember when Joe House, when the day before we did that debate, Joe, I spoke to Joe, and she said, well, I'm not sure if I want to do this debate, because the BBC has said that that there's that we're not going to be engaging with anybody that is a climate skeptic. And I said, well, look, we're not the BBC, you know. Anyway, so eventually she did it, and she did, I think, a very good job. You know, it's just, I think it's, you know, if you go and look for it, it's called if is climate change really man-made. And it still stands up today, I think, as you're listening to it thinking, well, why am I not hearing more of this discussion, since this policy is impacting so massively all around the world, including China to a certain extent. But, I mean, you do think, well, maybe we've got to invade China if we actually really want to make a difference to climate change.
I think Martin. That's a provocative remark, don't you?
No, I don't know. But, I mean, you know, is it like, if you look at apparently the Chinese are producing almost half of the greenhouse gases, not quite half, but almost half the greenhouse gases on the planet. And their moves towards deindustrialization, or, you know, less environmentally damaging industrialization, are, you know, not very slow. They also see this, a lot of this, as an attack on them. You know, the Chinese saying, well, look, you know, this is actually having a go at us. It's not really about the environment. You're just trying to stop us producing stuff and becoming an industrial powerhouse of the planet.
Well, look, let's just unpack this logically. If you accept that carbon dioxide released since the Industrial Revolution, and even more so now, because, you know, we've massively increased the amount since, because of the industrialization of developing countries like China, if you accept that, then the argument is that you've got to actually reduce carbon emissions, which means that poorer countries like China, or even poorer countries like India, should be allowed to industrialize and emit carbon, which means that wealthy countries have got to cut back, because they are the ones that created most of the problem in the first place. And now the Chinese have accepted, they do go to these climate conferences, and they've accepted, their scientists are part of the general consensus, that this is a problem. But they're saying, you can't put this all onto us. Our people, each individual Chinese actually generates much less carbon than the average American, for example. And therefore, we have got to, if we're going to cut back a bit and slow down our industrial development, or green it, that's what they've moved rapidly into solar panel production, for example, with state support. They actually bought out the people who were, you know, the best social solar panels people from Australia, and re-embedded that in China. They're the big producers of solar panels.
Martin, you know, these production of solar panels is also environmentally destructive. The idea that, you know, this seems to me is at the heart of a lot of this, is that there is this kind of notion that because there's no pollution being produced at the point of use, that there was no pollution produced in making it. I mean, it's like, you know, much of the electricity that's put into these electric cars is coming from gas-fired power stations, is coming from nuclear power stations, and it's just really putting the problem out of sight, and out of sight, out of mind, supposedly.
Well, I think that if everybody accepts that we've got to reduce carbon footprints, and that's a big if, because you could say, well, some people don't, but most major governments do, including the Chinese government, including the US government, including the British government. Maybe they're all wrong, but that's what the line is. They're all going to Egypt next week, and everybody turning up there will be based around the idea that we're going to reduce carbon footprints. Now, I'm not against reducing carbon footprints, because not what we used to obsess about before the latest cycle was peak oil, and that we're going to run out of these fossil fuels, and that's why we've got to conserve them and use them wisely, and not just on point, you know, silly consumption. I mean, look at the US, where after the 1973 oil price rise, they started to build more energy efficient cars, and then they just said, sod it, we're just going to build any cars we like. And the Humvee, look at all the huge cars that we drive around now, which are totally energy inefficient. Efficiency is a positive goal, whether or not carbon dioxide causes global warming. And that's
correct.
That's something that we need to look at. And of course, environmental destruction is not just carbon emission. It's soil loss. It's pollution of the seas and oceans. It's all sorts of things. And that what's happened is with this global warming debate is it's been turned into the only issue, when in actual fact there's loads of other issues. And of course, the Western powers are using this as a stick to beat developing countries and say, you've got to reduce your... Well, the idea is, of course, that they will buy carbon emissions from the wealthy, and the hedge fund managers will manage these carbon emissions permissions. This is the idea behind it all. There's an alternative to that, as the Chinese communists would say, is we could just have a plan for reducing carbon emissions. We don't need the stock markets involved at all. We just decide how much we're going to emit, and then we work around that, which is what actually we did in World War II. You know, we had plans for how much fossil fuel we were going to use, but they want a market solution.
I'm not sure if you remember the Panama Papers, Martin, and as part of that, out came this little revelation. The BBC did a rather nice article on it, that the company that was set up to manage these carbon trading system was owned and controlled by Prince Charles at the time, now King Charles. And they were saying, well, isn't it interesting that he set up this business to run carbon credits and carbon trading around the world, but then he's also lobbying at the same time for it to happen, and he's in a very powerful position in order to, you know, now to sign all this stuff off as his. Now, another thing which I remember, I think we talked about a couple of weeks ago, was this whole idea of these offshore wind farms all sitting on seabeds and with money going to the Crown. So it seems that there is some big vested interests involved in this also, Joe.
Yep. I think Martin's far more interesting on this than I am.
Okay.
I think I've spoken enough. I do have to shoot off, Tony. It's
absolutely fine. And you know, thank you very much for your time.
Lovely to be here. Thank you very much for having me. Appreciate it.
Can you just remind listeners of, you know, whereabouts they can find you, the various outlets you're writing for at the moment, and your own website?
Yep. So you'll find, the annoying thing about Vice is that the all sort of historical articles for them are now in their American version, because when you write for them, there would be a UK version and an American version. Sometimes they'd get translated into other languages, but they're all American. But anyway, you can find them all online. So things like Underground is turned into Subway, and Colour is spelt differently, and this sort of stuff. But anyway, that probably doesn't matter to anyone apart from me. But otherwise, joe-banks.com.
And you've been doing some stuff for the cable and any other outlets?
Nothing very interesting, really. No.
So where can we just find you on the Bristol Cable website, I suppose?
You'll find the pieces I've done. The piece I've done about St James's Priory, you'll find there, and the piece I've done about Western Harbour, you'll find them on the Bristol Cable website.
Okay, well, you are allowed now to extricate yourself from the studio.
Thank you.
So thanks ever so much for joining us.
Pleasure.
And refreshing our memory on the history of the city. I think it's like my grandfather used to say, eyes and no eyes. You know, this whole idea of where you're looking at stuff around you, the bricks and mortar in two dimensions.
Well, it's all, I mean, actually,
seeing inside it.
Sitting where we're sitting now in Stokes Croft, you know, all this stuff is literally yards away from us. Where Bevin went in his horse and cart every day to pick up that mineral water, that's literally 50 yards away, or St James's Priory in the other direction.
Well, I think we've got to have some sort of memorial to it. In a similar way, you know, there was all this. There's been talk over many years about having some kind of centre for about the slave trade. Looking at Bristol's, I remember there was the exhibition up at Bristol Temple Meads back, I think it was in 2008, 200 years after the abolition of slavery, which really didn't pull its punches about Bristol's involvement with the slave trade.
No, I mean, it's very peculiar that all these things have received so little attention. Yeah.
Well, it's so little public money. I mean, isn't that why we pay our taxes? So that we've got some sort of cultural life in the city, which is recognised, rather than hijacked by Business West and some individual like Andrew Kelly is employed by them, using public money to decide what's important in the Festival of Ideas and in our history. You know, that's, I suppose, what's going on here, is that the business community, if you can call them that, these people that are kind of business lobby effectively in the city, very closely connected to the merchant venturers, with Savage himself being a former master of the merchant venturers, deciding what our culture is. And I think, you know, we've got to fight back against that. Anyway, sorry,
I agree with that.
Thank you ever so much for your contribution.
Thank you. Cheers, Tony.
Anyway, I think, Martin, we can launch off now into looking at Prime Minister's questions this week, where the Leader of the Opposition, Keir Starmer, he was looking at this whole business of the Channel migrants, the 30,000 that cross the Channel. I think this is fascinating that Starmer is now becoming almost a sort of champion of the Red Wall, you know, saying, well, you know, why have the Conservatives done anything about this? So let's have a listen to that now from Prime Minister's Questions this week with Rishi Sunak, the new Prime Minister, for a second time facing Keir Starmer, leader of the opposition.
He says he's getting a grip, he's got a plan. So let's have a look at that plan. The Rwanda deal was launched in April. It cost the taxpayer £140 million and rising. The number of people deported to Rwanda is zero. Since then, 30,000 people have crossed the channel in small boats. It's not working, is it? He hasn't got a grip.
Mr. Speaker, we on this side of the House are clear that we want to defend our borders. When the Shadow Home Secretary this weekend was asked, she couldn't answer a simple question if the party opposite was in favour of higher or lower migration. It's that simple. The Home Secretary and I, when it comes to tackling our migration, reducing migration, we are on the same page. That party's policy, it's a blank page, Mr. Speaker.
So, is this new tune from Labour here, Martin, basically criticising the Tories for not stopping these, what, you know, you and others call asylum seekers coming across the channel?
Well, what they're doing is they're saying that you promised to do X, Y and Z and you haven't delivered it. And the reason they haven't delivered it we could go into, but that's the line of attack that they're adopting. And of course the Tories are open to this because in actual fact it's very difficult to reduce these numbers. And by promising to reduce them and then not reducing them, they make themselves, open themselves to attack. The underlying problems are far bigger than all of this, and we could discuss them. But I mean, obviously what the opposition are doing is, you know, you've got a Home Secretary that doesn't know her own job. You know, you basically haven't managed to get anybody to Rwanda because there's no legal way to get them there. So what are you talking about? And there's no realism about the asylum policy as a whole, because the policy of the Tory government is to make it so difficult to claim asylum in this country that people won't come. And that is just wrong. They're going to come however difficult you make it, and therefore you've got a problem with dealing with them because they're not going to go away. You can say go away, but that's the whole point. They're coming whether you want them or not. What are you going to do about it?
Well, good question. And I mean, it seems quite obvious that, I mean, we know now, I mean, we covered this with Alex Perry in his book, The Rift, interviewing him about 5 years ago about this migrant business and the whole, the fact that it is a mafia run thing, you know. And we've got this this headline this week about 12,000 young Albanian men coming in, none of whom are actually really asylum seekers, although they've got tales to tell which might keep them in the country, and massive amounts of money being spent on accommodating these people whilst their claims are looked at. So let's have a listen to this little bit from Prime Minister's Questions, where we hear about 40,000 migrants now costing £5.6 million a day.
Scott Benton.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Nearly 40,000 illegal immigrants have crossed the channel so far this year, landing taxpayers with a hotel bill of £5.6 million per day to accommodate them. Is it any wonder that millions of people in this country are furious with the situation? Prime Minister, during the summer, you set out a comprehensive 10-point plan to tackle this issue. Everybody on this side of the chamber wants you to succeed in this aim. When can we expect the firm action the British people are demanding?
Well, Mr. Speaker, I know this issue is rightly a priority for my honourable friend. It's a priority for his constituents, and I can reassure them that it is a priority for me and this government too. Whether it's the Nationalities and Borders Act or the further measures we are planning to take, we will defend our borders, stop the illegal crossings, and ensure that there is fairness and compassion in our system. That is the way to restore trust, and that is what his constituents and the British people deserve.
Now, the trouble with the Labour argument here, Martin, is that this is actually a new government. They're having a go at a Home Secretary who's been replaced recently.
Well, except that the Tories have been in power for 12 years. So the idea that this has suddenly sprung on them and they've been, they are responsible for the state of the asylum system. Nobody else. They've been in charge for 12 years. Now, can I just pick up on this thing about illegal crossings of the channel? It is not illegal to cross the channel in a rubber dinghy. It may be inconvenient for the British government to accept that, but in actual fact, people are allowed to do that. It's not illegal. And the reason they do it is because under international law, you cannot claim asylum under international law in a country unless you're physically there, which is why they have to physically cross the channel. The French have been saying for many years, there's a straightforward way to solve this. Send your immigration police and people over to France, process them in France, decide which ones you want and which ones you don't want, and then send the others away. There's 100,000 people waiting for an asylum decision. Now, that 100,000 people, that's the longest waiting list for it. That's because they don't employ people to process the people because they're trying to deter them. So they then have to be kept in accommodation while their cases are dealt with. And of course, this is all a part of the deterring people. But in actual fact, until the recent surge in young Albanians, most of the people who crossed the channel in rubber dinghies, 80% of them were found to be genuine asylum seekers. Now, there's plenty of people in Britain who don't think that we should asylum seekers, but international law says that you can't turn them away.
I don't think that that's a fact. You just said that 80% of them were actual genuine asylum seekers.
Yes, they are, Tony. They are.
Let's just
make a logical point, Tony.
Just a minute, Martin. Let me just have my say. You've just had a very good say there. You can't just, as soon as I start speaking, talk over me and interrupt me. Well, you can, but you're not really making your argument by doing that. All I'm saying is that as I was saying earlier, Alex Perry has explained that there is an organised crime network doing this, and the most ordinary people who are asylum seekers, etc., cannot afford the money to pay these organised criminals to do that sort of thing. What we're looking at here, quite clearly, is an organised crime network which is bringing in people to undermine the British kind of labour system and to undermine people's wages, to undermine people's pay and conditions. This is a deliberate assault, actually, post-EU. And that's why we've got 12,000 young Albanians here, and nobody from these, or there are maybe some, but this is overwhelmingly more to do with bringing in organised crime than it is to do with helping people who are suffering in conflicts.
Can I just make the point that if you are an asylum seeker in this country, and there's quite a lot of people, there's 100,000 people on the waiting list to have their claims looked into, you cannot work. You're not allowed to, under the rules. What we could do is, plenty of people are actually qualified doctors and so on. We could actually employ them in the health service, but they're not allowed to be employed because they are asylum seekers. Yeah, they have to live on handouts because that's the policy.
So many of these people then just disappear. And even though they're not allowed to, they do whatever they want. That's the nature we have the same sort of thing for many years with people going over to the United States on holiday and then ending up working, that sort of thing.
That happens all over the world, and it's because the world is on the move. It's on the move because of the globalization of capitalism since 1979. And when, for example, Albania.
Well, it's called globalization.
It's called globalization. Albania. Let's talk about Albania. Albania was a communist dictatorship until 1989. People in Albania were forbidden to leave, and it was virtually impossible to go there. And they were the only pro-Chinese state in Europe. Because they split with the Soviets, and then they split with the Yugoslavs.
Yeah, Martin,
history is important, Tony.
Can you come to the point?
All right, I'll come to the point. After 1989, a free market free-for-all was imposed on the Albanians as it was imposed on the Russians. And instead of Albania becoming a moderately prosperous, mixed economy, it just became a basket case. They allowed, for example, a Ponzi scheme to develop because the Western advisors said, let them set up banks. So they set up banks. It was a Ponzi scheme where everybody lost all of their money. So in other words, a lot of these economic migrants are running away from the policies we've imposed on them.
them.
Okay, good point. Thank you for making it. Now, let's have a listen to another clip from PMQs. A lot about the migrant thing this week, where one of the MPs picks up Rishi Sunak, the new Prime Minister, and saying, actually, those questions that Starmer was asking you about earlier, you just dodged them, didn't you?
Sarah Jones.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Speaker. The Leader of the Opposition asked the Prime Minister who broke the asylum system. He dodged the question.
Yeah. Yeah.
The truth, Mr. Speaker, is that the backlog is now so great, decision-making so collapsed, and returns so low, at a tenth of what they used to be, that the criminal gangs have a business model to die for. Yeah. Whose fault is that?
Mr. Speaker, the reason we are in this situation is because of the unprecedented number of people arriving here illegally, often from safe third countries. Now, if the party opposite was really serious about this, they would realise that we have to stop illegal migration, that we have to stop the exploitation of vulnerable people abroad. But they have opposed every single measure we have taken. They're not serious about this problem because they don't think it matters.
So, I suppose what I'm coming to here is that there is a certain similarity between the organised crime involved in the migrant crisis and the organised crime at the heart of the City of London, Martin.
And the organised crime at the drugs industry and the similar problem you've got. You can say you're opposed to organised crime, but if there's money to be made, organised criminals will get in there and organise themselves to get that money. And you can say you're going to squash it. They've tried to squash the drugs trade for decades and with no success whatsoever. Now, we've now got a situation, for example, in the whole of Europe, especially Eastern Europe, where the economy's collapsing. These people are going to run away. The Ukrainians are now going to be living through the winter, possibly with no water and no heating. They're going to get in their motor cars and they're going to drive to the West, aren't they? Maybe we shouldn't have started the war in the Ukraine. Maybe we shouldn't have knocked down the stable state in Libya, which actually was like a great big blockage to people crossing the Mediterranean. We didn't, but lots of the people on the Tory benches supported us knocking down the state in Libya. And of course, the people in Italy were not very happy about that because they got that full in the face. What's actually going on in the Channel?
What's going on in the Channel is tiny
compared to what's going on Sicily.
Martin, I suppose what I'm saying is that actually behind much of our foreign policy is organised crime, actually.
Well, it is, that's right. And, of course, the globalist elite, if you look at the alt-right websites, the globalist elite want all of this population movement as a way of undermining the Christian way of life in the West. The globalist elite wanted to take the oil resources in Libya and they thought they could impose a stable state. They wanted to take the oil resources in Iraq and thought they could impose a stable state. They wanted to stop the Russians in Afghanistan and therefore prevent the Chinese linking up, so we invaded Afghanistan. That all of these things are part of what's it, the John Martin song from the 1970s? It's one world, like it or not. It's one world, believe it or not. And of course you can't do things like that, smash stable states like Iraq and Libya, and then that has knock-on effects on Syria and all the other states around there, and then expect we're all going to go in for a nice cup of tea and there's not going to be any problems in the Channel. The reality is World War III started on 9/11 and there's lots of refugees running around all over the place. The economic policies we've imposed on the developing world in Africa, in other parts of the world, in South America, in the US case, have actually impoverished most of the people. The Mexican situation, for example, they got rid of the ejidos, which was the right to land in a particular community. They got rid of it. Yeah. And all those people got on their bikes and they went to the United States. What else are they going to do?
That's right. I mean, it's a part of globalization, the breakdown of nationalism. The idea, I mean, I was watching some, maybe we could have something about it next week, but watching something last night about the World Economic Forum and their plans to just undermine all confidence in national governments and to also get them involved in debt traps, bankrupt them, so that the only thing left standing is the World Economic Forum. Anyway, another crime to look at this week, which is, I found pretty shocking, is a case against 11 people accused of taking part in a child sex ring. This is in the Glasgow Times, involving witchcraft, attempted murder and serious sexual violence. Seven men and four women are facing a 14-page indictment listing 43 different charges of alleged crimes between January 2010 and March 2020. Various addresses in Glasgow. The accusations involve multiple young children, mainly centre around two girls and a boy. Some charges claim the alleged victims were forced to take part in satanic seances where they were told they were drinking blood and eating a heart. This isn't really the sort of thing that should be being done to children, as it's alleged. It's claimed they were made to kill animals, made to use a Ouija board, similar objects to call on spirits and demons. One of the young girls was told to have been shut in a microwave, a fridge, an oven and a freezer in an attempt to kill her. There are also claims that members of the group did clap, cheer and verbally encourage, as well as video record the children being sexually abused. Ian Owens, 44, Elaine Lannery, 38, Leslie Williams, 41, Paul Brannan, 40, Marianne Gallagher, 38, Scott Forbes, 49, Barry Watson, 46, Mark Carr, 49, Richard Gahan, 45, Leona Lang, 50, and John Clark, 46, deny the charges they face. And they're also mentioned, a whole bunch of other names are also mentioned. A hearing at the High Court in Glasgow on Monday, Judge Lord Beckett described the unique situation. He said questions were raised over how best to clear evidence from some witnesses in the trial were given until the end of the year to lodge any complaints about proceedings ahead of next year. So interesting charges. I mean, it does sound, Martin, on the surface of it, with so many people accused and video evidence involved, that that this isn't just some sort of spurious attempt by the Crown prosecutors in Scotland to make up a trial out of nowhere.
Well, it's the first I've heard of this, obviously, and if these allegations are true, as you say, it's absolutely shocking and horrible. And, of course, one of the things that immediately strikes me is they've got loads of video evidence. This is one of the big Achilles heels of certain kind of organised crime groups, is that they take videos of themselves doing stuff. And you feel like thinking, why do you want to do that? But, of course, they do it for their own gratification in this particular case, and then all the evidence is there, isn't it? This is what the Epstein cases are all about. It's all being videoed. It's all being filmed.
The second charge is against 10 members of the group, apart from Forbes, who've been accused of assaulting one of the girls over half a decade, from when she was 6 years old, including drugging her, running a wheelchair into her legs, putting a black plastic bag over her head and forcing her to eat cat food. I mean, this sort of thing, I mean, you know, it's generally thought, I mean, I get this quite a lot. Oh, you know, this satanic abuse is just stupid. It's no such thing as ritual abuse. Here they're doing things like putting masks on to scare these 6-year-olds. It must be absolutely horrific if these prove to be true, these allegations, for those children particularly. And I mean, one of the things that annoys me so much is we've had this from Ian Hislop since he took over Private Eye many years ago, that this is all just nonsense, it's rubbish, and this whole idea of satanic ritual abuse is just a complete nonsense and fantasy, and anybody that says it exists is a lunatic. Well, maybe the Scottish courts are lunatics, Martin.
Well, if obviously we still don't know what the verdict is, and we must be careful about that, because there's also a tendency to sensationalise and you know, for people to want a story out of this. Now, I would also point out, I'm perfectly willing to accept that satanic abuse exists, but most abuse of children is not satanic and is equally reprehensible, and in fact far more widespread than people realise. And, you know, there's an awful lot of, I mean, I think it's over 200 children every year are killed by their carers, outright killed. And that must be thousands and thousands of others who are severely injured. That's the reality of Britain.
Yeah, well, another crime going on. This is, I'll put a link up to that on our show page, thisweek.org.uk. Another crime going on is the, apparently in the United States, the United States government has been making strains of COVID, trying to predict the next possible strain of COVID by manufacturing them, carrying on with this kind of gain of function research in the United States. I kind of find this almost impossible to believe that anybody, after what's happened over in Wuhan, could then take that research back to the United States and almost kind of carry it on, trying to predict what the next strain of COVID might be. Well, of course, that might then get released and become the next strain of COVID. What the hell are they playing at?
Well, the first strain of COVID was a gain of function research. This is what Jeffrey Sachs and The Lancet are saying. They've pointed the finger clearly at Peter Daszak, Ego Health Alliance and all the rest of it. And of course, the Iranians have been saying all along that they think that the original strain of COVID is a biological warfare agent, as are the Russians. And the Russians this week, in fact, took all of their evidence about biological laboratories in the Ukraine to the UN Security Council, and the West squashed any investigation. But of course, people in the rest of the world, China voted with Russia, and lots of people in the rest of the world who are not on the Security Council all think that this is quite likely what's been going on. And, things are worse than people realise. They are quite capable of doing very nasty things. And that includes, it's not just to sell vaccines and get us all chipped. It's actually about destroying rivals to the deep state maniacs that run the Western system.
Well, there is something evil about the appalling side effects that many people seem to have suffered due to the jabs. Including these kind of heart attacks and stuff. So I thought it'd be useful to have a listen now. I mean, we don't often hear MEPs anymore on this program, probably because we don't have any UK MEPs, but there is still, I mean, even though it is a talking shop, the European Parliament, they don't really make any kind of policy decisions. They just get to vote on the European Commission appointees' policy documents and their policies. But there are some excellent MEPs out there, and I believe this woman is French. I'm not absolutely sure. Her name's Christine Anderson, and here she talks for a couple of minutes now about Pfizer and the absolutely appalling, apparently, I mean, this is according to her, obviously, but I mean, we know Pfizer is a criminal company. I mean, they have a very strong track record of criminal fines and criminal activity and being found guilty by the courts. And still they do exist, and they are the main plank, apparently, of these mRNA vaccines and to be totally trusted on another level. But this, what she's saying is that effectively the Pfizer jabs have been being used on pregnant women when they were never tested on them, and the results are proving pretty horrific. So let's have a listen to Christine Anderson, MEP, now.
They go on with the gaslighting, labeling vaccine hesitancy, this is what they call it, as anti-Western and anti-EU. Can you believe this? So anyone who is not willing to let themselves be injected with this vaccine is anti-Western and anti-EU. No, ladies and gentlemen, let's be clear about this. If you do not want to poison your body, and it is your choice to do with your body whatever you please. Remember, my body, my choice? That's their narrative, actually. Remember that. So, if you do not want to take that vaccine, that has nothing to do with being anti-Western or anti-EU. It is pro-people. That's what it is. And it is anti-globalist elites. That's what it is. And in this action plan, they refer several times to not only COVID-19, but now they slip in influenza. So this will be the next step for their measures, whether it be vaccinations or non-pharmaceutical interventions like wearing masks or staying at home curfews. Then they will be able to do so when there is an influenza pandemic or wave. And whenever I think they could not possibly come up with yet another atrocity to inflict on people, they sure as heck prove me wrong. The EU Commission proposes now the prioritized administration of the update injection for the vulnerable groups, and then they list who these vulnerable groups are. And they start by saying people aged 60 years and older, individuals with underlying conditions. No problem there. But then they list another group. And you really need to brace yourselves for that one. the vulnerable group among those who should be given priority to take this update vaccine are pregnant women. I have never heard anything more despicable than that, because the point is this: they do not know what this vaccine does to the unborn child. They simply have no clue. And yet, now they're pushing it on pregnant people. And keep in mind, there has been a drop in birth rate. We don't know why that happened. You would expect the opposite of that. I mean, people were locked down. Remember what happened when they had a blackout in New York in the 70s? 9 months later, they were like babies left and right. But not this time. People were locked up for months in their homes. Nothing. Drop in birth rate? Interesting question. And these are the questions that we should be asking.
Yes, we certainly should. And there's also been, various commentators have been looking at this, not least of which Dr. John Campbell on YouTube, is the unexplained increase in the mortality rate, more and more people dying. So what do you make of this, Martin? What she's saying there is that there's a basic principle been violated here, that certain groups that she listed there, these jabs were not tested on them deliberately, and then now they're without any kind of examination. They're being prescribed for those very groups which were thought it was too dangerous to test these jabs on. I mean, it's just a completely absurd situation where those people who are potentially most vulnerable to getting damaged by the jab are. Are now being prescribed this stuff.
Well, the mRNA vaccine technology has been around for a while, but on the precautionary principle, the big pharmaceutical companies in the West, like Pfizer and Moderna, weren't allowed to use it. But because of the, pandemic, all of this was waived, and the normal test that, it would take 10 to 15 years to bring a vaccine to use on humans, because you've got to test it on monkeys, you've got to do all sorts of things before you run out a normal vaccine. So the mRNA technology has been there, but they weren't allowed to use it. And of course, what's happened with the crisis is that's all, it's a classic shock doctrine stuff. A la Naomi Klein, as soon as we've got a crisis, then suddenly everybody, we need a vaccine and we need it now, and we realise that it's not going to be properly tested for safety, but hey, we've got, this is what we've got to do. And all of that, I have got a problem with it, but I haven't got a problem with people criticising it. I think that's right.
I think one of the most shocking things about it, I shouldn't use the word shocking. Kevin Cahill told us we should never do that. Journalists should not be shocked. But it's just the fact that, so many people seem to have been led down this line that, for example, we were taken off the air for raising concerns about potential dangers due to these vaccines. And I'd just like to play a clip now from Dr. Sam White. He's one of those that stood up against, and in fact, he actually stopped being a GP. He could not get involved at all in the rollout of the vaccines, because he was basically telling his patients that I wouldn't have it, my family wouldn't have it. So, but anyway, I thought it was interesting. He did a very good sort of 2 years after the introduction of the pandemic, whatever, in 2020. It's like 2 years down the line. He explains why he spoke out. So this is a little clip, and I put the longer version of this up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk.
I've struggled to find any truth in what people have been told. And it got to the point where I was having sleepless nights, was anxious. When the injections were rolled out in December 2020, I said to my colleagues, I'm not getting involved in this. I also said, you'll need a lot of adrenaline because of the known contents, which is polyethylene glycol, polysorbate 80, those things. Many of people in the population will have antibodies already to PEG, and therefore at risk of allergic reactions or anaphylaxis. Even when that started happening, they didn't stop the injections. They just said sit in a chair for 20 minutes afterwards. I'm not even sure they do that anymore. And of course, the very first people that were subjected to this were the frail, vulnerable and elderly, those on many medications. Of course, they were never included in the trial. And you've since seen, at that time and throughout, there's not been full disclosure on either the contents of the vaccines or the side effects. And recently, one of the vaccine manufacturers was made to release a list of side effects, 10 pages long. The injections were rolled out on the basis of 2 months of data. And we're talking about a biological agent, which I can't see how you can test that safely when it would normally take 10 to 12 years. Okay. And certainly in that time, there was enough to say prior to them being introduced that it would be harmful. So if you think what happened with the vax injection for the first SARS virus, where they only got as far as animal studies, and then it was never rolled out at all, because the animals developed this what we call antibody-dependent enhancement, and they got a far worse form of the illness than they would have otherwise done when they were re-exposed to the virus, and they all died. And then even prior to December 2020, we knew that this spike protein was very similar in structure to a protein expressed on the placenta, syncytin. And so you wonder then, well, are people then going to develop antibodies that could cause inflammation of the placenta and cause miscarriage? So that was what was going through my mind, enough to say, I don't want to do this. I'm not going to do this. And then what I later realized in the January was that people were basically being phoned up by external operators, some admin staff in the surgery, and that was their job, to go to these other sites to have this injection, because it couldn't be done on site anyway, because it had to be stored at a very low temperature. And then I was starting to see people be injured and hearing again and again the narrative that they weren't having it for a medical reason. Okay, if you're having a medical intervention, I mean, there's got to be a medical justification for that. Seeing the grandchildren going on holiday isn't one, that's coercion. With the introduction of the Coronavirus Act, we have to think that every aspect of the practice of medicine and medical ethics, well-established laws on informed consent, and the famous case that's quoted quite often is Montgomery, were inverted. So informed consent doesn't matter. And I've got a document, Freedom of Information Request, where the Royal College of GPs acknowledges that the doctor can't give you any advice on long-term effects because they don't know it. That's what it says. I'm not an expert. I was just a regular doctor, small-town doctor, if you like, seeing this and thinking, at what point do people say, no, we're not doing this? And I think that when government acted, what we'll see in time is completely unlawfully with lockdowns, because it doesn't benefit anyone. You know, quarantine is for the sick, okay? Lockdown for healthy people is tyranny. Simple as that in my book. But when they acted unlawfully and asked doctors to go along with it, which there should have been a united front which said, no, get lost. Because our duty is not to you, certainly not to the World Economic Forum, it's to that person who's sitting in the chair in front of us. Okay? And let's say, Ash, you came to see me in December 2020. Now, no one asked for my opinion because they were all being sent elsewhere. But let's say you came to see me and said, let's have a chat. What do you think of this, doctor? and I would have told you what happened before in the previous experiments. I would have told you I can't give you any medium to long term side effects. You know, there's a whole book produced by the GMC on good medical practice, which they regard now as unimportant in my experience, because in there is all about informed consent. That doesn't matter to the General Medical Council. I would have said to you, I'm not going to have it. So why would I recommend it to you? Okay? I wouldn't recommend it to my friends or family. So I didn't want my patients having it. Over my dead body, really. So I said, no, I'm out of here, I'm resigning.
What do you make of the of what Sam is saying? I mean, I think one of the most shocking things for me is he is almost like a witness from the medical professional side of seeing almost, I mean, this is what I would agree. I mean, I said, what I've seen is this almost like this kind of show taking place in front of him, which has got very little, if any, relevance to what his professional medical knowledge tells him is ethical and right. And I suppose the most important point he's making is that he's feeling, as a doctor, completely unable to make the right decisions for his patient. He's saying things like, well, they're getting jabs so they can go on holiday. They're getting jabs so they can see their children. I mean, this is all what we were talking about last week, it seems to me, a system of coercion, of marketing, rather than of a one-to-one relationship between patient and doctor.
Well, I have to bring you up on the fact that you just used the word shocking, but never mind. We'll just let that one pass. Well, I think the legitimate arguments about vaccines, especially mRNA vaccines, and don't forget that in China and Russia, nobody has had an mRNA vaccine. They've had Sinopharm and Sputnik, and in Cuba, they've developed four vaccines because they're under embargo, so they wouldn't have been allowed to have any anyway. The Iranians said, we wouldn't have your vaccines because we think it's a biological warfare attack on us. We are not taking any vaccines from you, but in any case, you won't give us any, because it was very clear that the enemy countries were not going to be helped by the West in the pandemic. So they got a very different perspective on all of this than people in the West. Now, I'm perfectly willing to listen to arguments about vaccines, mRNA vaccines, the evil of pharmaceutical companies, the attempts to try and control society through the release of a biological warfare agent. All of that makes sense to me, but the people in the deep state in the West didn't just wait for a random mutation to happen in China. They've orchestrated all of this. And that's why in Iran and in China, they had lockdowns, effective lockdowns, because the country's at war. What we had in this country was a load of messing around, delaying lockdowns, then bringing them in, and then releasing them too soon. Rishi Sunak's eat out to help out was simply wrong. It cost the economy $600 million in direct subsidies and hell of a lot more in the subsequent lockdown. You've got to separate vaccines from lockdowns, Tony. Yeah.
You always bang on about this Rishi Sunak's eat out to help out. There are a lot of people argue around the world, including those from Belarus, etc., that the whole lockdown was a complete waste of time. Actually, all that needed really to happen was that the most vulnerable should have been protected and given some ivermectin, and society should have just carried on as normal. So eat out to help out was almost like a brief return to normality.
Well, that's Rishi Sunak himself accepts that it was wrong, because they then had to impose a subsequent lockdown as the second wave took hold. Well, in China, they've lost less than 5,000 people to COVID.
Martin, they didn't have
less than 5,000 in the whole of China.
They didn't have to, Martin, they didn't have to impose any lockdown, actually, not even the first lockdown, and certainly not the second one, that was the Halloween lockdown.
Iran, they had a lockdown, Tony, and in China, they had a lockdown because they perceived this as warfare. You perceive this as a threat to our right to and all the rest of it, and all this ethical argument. This is warfare. We've got to move on from this kind of argument. World War III is about to kick off. It's about warfare. Lockdowns are used in warfare. Yeah, air raid shelters are used in warfare.
It's also about warfare on one's own people.
That's the war, yeah.
Which is being foisted on us by foisted on the Chinese particularly. basically by their own government these days, mm-hmm. and they're having lockdowns down, still continuing on with
the
lockdowns.
The zero lockdown policy they're pursuing is causing immense costs to them, but their economy has continued to grow, and they've managed to actually get through the crisis, whereas what's going to happen in this country is we've got massive holes in our budget deficit, and our fiscal policy and budget, because we've got it all wrong.
Martin, you're going to let me speak because you keep talking over me. By simply clicking a button on a computer, the Chinese government is now remotely switching people's vaccine passports to code yellow, which means they have to rush to get a COVID test and hope it's negative so they can get back a green QR code and participate as normal in society. This is Song Pingyang, which is a Chinese account, outside China, some Chinese expat talking about what's going on. He's getting sent videos from his friends in China. So this is what has become in China since the Wuhan's initial COVID outbreak. A green QR code is needed to access any public transport, stores, or go to work. That means your COVID test can't be older than 48 hours. If you keep it current, it costs each person $50 a month in testing fees. So COVID in China has been totally turned into a system of social control, but you seem to applaud that.
China is at war with the West. They have drawn the correct conclusion. Listen, you asked me, is
Martin,
it my turn or your
Martin,
turn?
It's at war. Martin, it's not at war. Well, in some ways it is at war with the West, but as a result, it seems to have been now waging war on its own people.
Look, the perception in Iran, you do quite a lot of work for Press TV. The perception in Iran is that when COVID hit Iran, it didn't come in through a port, it didn't come in through an airport, it didn't come in through tourism. It started right at the top of the political elite in Iran, who all started dying of COVID. And that's why they immediately, and don't forget, this was just after the assassination of Soleimani, who was their leading general. So they perceived it in those terms. And they certainly had lockdowns, masks, and they did what they could. The Chinese Chinese haven't said much, although they did support the Russian motion at the UN General Assembly this week. We want a full investigation into the US's biological warfare program.
Martin, are you justifying that everybody has got to have a permanent COVID device on their app to tell them that whether they've got to get tested, whether they're allowed to access public services? I mean, it seems that you're turning into the psycho in the corner there, saying that it's okay for governments to do this to, you know, tens of millions or billions of their population to keep them under control.
It's to win the war, Tony. The Chinese will win the war because they didn't do the wrong thing at the beginning of the crisis. They perceived correctly that they were under attack, and then they adopted, they pressed the button, biological warfare attack.
I suppose we will have to see as to whether the Chinese people accept this and go along with it.
Well, up to now, the opinion poll, the Harvard University carries out extensive opinion poll surveys inside China they generally support their government's policy. Just as the people in New Zealand supported the lockdown policy, and in Taiwan, which is the Republic of China, they had a similar policy, very similar to the mainland, and people there supported it. In this country, it was controversial, and therefore we didn't approach it in the right way. There's going to be an inquiry into all of this, and it will look into the decisions about
Martin,
when lockdowns.
Martin, you do have to allow a little bit of. I mean, I'll be over in New Zealand and chatting to the. Chatting to some sort of, I suppose that you would call them sporty types, builders, young men, they have absolutely not been jabbed. They're completely against the whole policy. They managed to get some sort of fake certificate so that they could go into bars and pubs during that time. And they just talk about themselves as the pure bloods. You know, we're not having any of this nonsense. And there's a very strong movement here. Some commentators, and one of whom I've spoken to, is completely convinced that Jacinda has had it now because of all these policies and the way that slowly people have woken up to the craziness of having a zero COVID policy that was a complete and utter failure in New Zealand. We've had something like 80% of people have now had COVID in New Zealand, and so their zero COVID thing went absolutely nowhere, and the penny is kind of dropping over here. Anyway, we're going to have to move on to part two in a minute. But just before we do that, do you want to? I'll let you have your final say, Martin, before we go to the break about China, because you know it seems to me that you know you and I are completely at odds here. You think it's okay to impose these mass surveillance, mass control systems on your population, and you say it's about war. I mean, to me, it just looks to me as if this is an excuse for the Chinese to suppress any potential uprising against the Communist Party, and they've used COVID as an excuse to do that.
Okay. Underlying all of this is the 9/11 attacks, which were definitely carried out by the US security forces with the Israelis and the British behind it. If you were the Chinese general staff or the Russian general staff or the Iranian general staff looking at that, you think, right, we've got to get ourselves ready to deal with this. As we go forward, there are probably going to be new biological warfare attacks, because that's what the Russians have uncovered in all of these biological warfare, which is what they are, laboratories in the Ukraine. And they went this week to the UN Security Council, said, we want a full investigation into all of this. The British, the French, the Americans, they blocked it. But everybody else in the world can see what's going on here. It's beginning. The people in the West who are worried about that. Don't forget, most people in the West have had these mRNA vaccines now. They've had them in New Zealand, too. And that's why the lockdown ended in the end, because they had to get everybody vaccinated. They could end the lockdown. That's the same here. Now, if most people have already had it, that ship has sailed. If we're all going to die of it, we're going to die of it, because nothing can be done about it. Maybe we shouldn't have gone to war in the first place. Maybe we shouldn't have been following these people at all.
One of the things that's becoming pretty clear is that the people who have had vaccines seem to be getting COVID more. So some say as much as 7-1 more than people that weren't vaccinated. And I'd like to, you know, actually next week, what I'll be doing, I hope, is to be looking a little bit more into New Zealand culture, a little bit more into the New Zealand farmer protests, which are massive over here, very similar to those going on in Holland, the policies that Jacinda is trying to bring in. But we're going to have our musical break now. Before that, I found this the other day from Christina Rossetti. She's actually, I didn't realise, a writer of Christian collects, which are, you know, a collection of collects. Can you have that? I suppose you can, or maybe I should look one out. But she says, Lord Jesus, everywhere and always, inspire us to refuse the evil and to choose the good. And, we beseech thee, give us grace never to judge our neighbour rashly, whilst one by one we ourselves endeavour to learn and to perform thy will for thine own name's sake. Amen.
You may talk about your people, I'm about it.
Yeah, so that is actually began with John Rutter and the Cambridge Singers, the song Joshua Fit the Battle of Jericho, recorded in 2018. Then we got London Beat, that was the song Thinking About You, and finally a sort of, I suppose, late 80s, early 90s, it was 1989 actually, version of the Beatles' Can't Buy Me Love by Nina Cherry. The Buffalo Stance is the name of that. I kind of getting a bit into this sort of late 80s, early 90s dance stuff and finding it almost, well, it was difficult to extricate myself from it as it was for Joe to be to get out of the studio today. Keep plying him with loads of questions. But anyhow, welcome back to Not the BCFM Politics Show. So thank you for switching off the psycho in the corner. For those that want to bypass that psycho on the new talkradio.org.uk stream and live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app, available free from all good app stores, including the Apple one, but not necessarily Google, with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. The most sensational, I think, news this week is really like punctured the Liz Truss bubble. We were hearing earlier about the planning decision, which was approved by a minister who was only in post for a few weeks. And of course, this is a similar thing with the Nord Stream pipeline explosions this week, Martin. We hear from the Russians that they've intercepted a text message or message of some sort that went between Liz Truss, over from Liz Truss over to Blinken, the US State Secretary of State, 1 minute after the explosions on the Nord Stream pipeline, saying it's done.
I've read this on the websites that I access, and if it's true, it's devastating. But I don't think it's been confirmed that there is actually such a you know, I'm waiting to hear proper confirmation of this. And I also have a big question. Why would Liz Truss be in on it? The deep state doesn't take people like that into their you know, she's just too far down the food chain.
She has a very clear, well, possibly, you're quite right, but she has a pretty clear stance on Russia, doesn't she?
Yes, and that's why they wouldn't need to have her involved in being directly... what the Russians are saying, and they you know, they claim they're going to stand this up, is that the Royal Navy were behind the attack on the pipeline and the attack on the Kerch Bridge and the attack on Sebastopol, and the British ambassador was called in Moscow this week to be presented with the evidence.
We'll be coming
and
to
they
that.
Said, we will be putting this evidence into the public domain, but we're going to run it past you first.
We're coming to that in a minute, but we're going to stick with this, I'm afraid, for the former hacker turned tech guru, Kim.com, over here in New Zealand, did a fascinating thread on Halloween about this, which is how do the Russians know the UK blew up the Nord Stream pipelines in partnership with the United States? Well, he says because Liz Truss used her iPhone to send a message to Secretary Blinken saying it's done a minute after the pipeline blew up and before anybody else knew. iCloud admin access rocks, he says. So it wasn't the phone that was hacked, he said, the context. He goes into quite a lot of detail in this thread, and I'll read some of it out now. He says it's not just the Five Eyes that have backdoor admin access to all big tech databases. Russia and China have sophisticated cyber units too. The funny thing is that government officials with top security clearance still prefer using iPhones over their NSA and GCHQ issued encrypted expletive deleted phones. So he's saying that the encrypted phones are, you know, they prefer using their iPhones for some reason. It's a bit like Cameron, I remember, and that cabinet loving to use WhatsApp the whole time because it was something that it was apparently more difficult for the British authorities to keep an eye on. Anyway, he says, Kim.com says he has no data security background. He did not once employ the best hackers in the world to do penetration testing for Fortune 500 companies, and none of those data security expert friends are now working for intelligence agency. So, but he goes into, you know, a fair amount of detail actually on this whole story, looking at these backdoor access, which is provided apparently by he says top secret means nothing to the top spy agencies in the world. Secrecy exists to keep citizens in the dark. Russia and China know exactly who blew up Nord Stream pipeline because in today's world, it's impossible for an operation like that to leave no trace. And he begins, let me explain. All the big tech companies are backdoored by every major spy agency. Every smartphone is an open mic to them. Every computer that's connected to the internet is wide open. All major chips and most hardware is trojanized. All the data that one spy agency collects is stolen by the others. All leaders of nations are targeted by spy tech, and not one of them, not even the US president, isn't spied on successfully 24/7 by multiple foreign and domestic agencies. Even the encrypted devices that spy agencies give to their leaders are backdoored. That's the reality. Occasional private conversations in zero tech environments are possible, but the rare exception, something like Nord Stream, involves hundreds of people from military agencies and the leadership of multiple countries. Impossible not to have a weak link in such a scenario. The perpetrators of major events understand their adversaries know exactly who did it, and it's a game they play against each other at the expense of ordinary people who become victims of stupid bleep swinging contests. It's a secret war that's been going on for decades. He says, I used to be a hacker turned data security consultant, hired the top hackers in the world. I was paid by the Fortune 500 companies to hack them. We never had any client we didn't hack successfully. That's the truth. There's no effective data security at all. Everything is wide open. Spy agencies with billion-dollar budgets have got coders in all leading tech companies implementing backdoors. It's impossible to keep them secret. Competing agencies, cyber criminals, and security analysts find them. That's why you constantly have to install new security patches. So anyway, I'll leave it at that. It goes on and on Kim.com's thread, but he's convinced that these intelligence agencies, Martin, know far, far, far more than they're telling, possibly even governments, but certainly the public.
Well, that sounds absolutely right to me. I mean, my doubt about this particular leak is that he is the source of it, rather than the Russian government. The Russian government haven't confirmed yet. I mean, they've got their own sources. If he's proved that tweet or whatever it was, not a tweet, you know, that text message was sent, that's interesting, but it's not, you know, it's just one piece of evidence. But the general thing he's saying is obviously true. I mean, and just think about the cracking of the Enigma code in World War II. The British cracked the code, but of course what they didn't do is shout from the rooftops, we've cracked your code. So in actual fact, what you do is you crack the code or you enter the other side's cyberspace, but of course you don't shout out from the rooftops that's what you've done. Although if you remember back to 2014, after the massacre in the Maidan Square in Kiev, there was a leak made of a phone call from Umas Piets, the Estonian foreign minister who's in Kiev, to Catherine Ashton, who is the EU's foreign policy person, where he basically told her that the shootings have been carried out by the new regime. And she goes, gosh, really? And of course, ultimately, he was approached by Agence France-Presse in Estonia, and he had to admit that the phone call was genuine. But I presume that was the Russian FSB. They were hacked in, and they knew exactly when they said they knew who'd done it. And Umas Piets told Ashton who'd done it, but they'd hacked in and they got the phone call. Now that's not hacking everybody or watching everybody. It's just going after the phone calls of the people you want to keep an eye on. But of course, you know, in the real world, you can't protect yourself, whoever you are, from people listening in on you. It's virtually impossible.
The Russians are pinning so much of this on the Brits. I mean, I suppose it's because of our so-called special relationship with America. And I mean, really, what seems to be going on is there's been a lot of talk about a lot of money being funneled into Ukraine versus Russia war. What's really going on is Britain is actually at war with Russia too, Martin, with these three attacks, the destruction of the Nord Stream pipeline, which is quite clearly an act of war against the Russians, plus the attack on Sevastopol last weekend, the Black Sea Fleet, which has brought a halt to all the grain supplies to Africa, which is
that's been resorted. The Turks, we can go into that in a minute, but the grain deal is back on. So it was cancelled, but yeah. It's back on.
It's suspended for a while. But also the Kerch Bridge attack. It seems that the Royal Navy, I mean, let's maybe look at last weekend's attack on the Black Sea Fleet. Apparently using underwater and aerial drones. And the Russians are really pretty annoyed about the fact that it's quite clearly this is the British doing this, they say, rather than the Ukrainians.
Well, there was also a US spy plane coordinating everything. So, you know, this is what was going on. I think there are a number of things to say about this. The British have been to the forefront in everything to do with what's been going on in the Ukraine. We've basically been the loyal, you know, the British Special Forces see themselves as the creme de la creme of this kind of cloak and dagger stuff. And the Americans encourage them in this kind of delusion so that we end up doing the dirty work the Americans want to be done, but that we end up doing it. And of course, what the Russians are doing, in my view, by pinning as much of this as possible on the British, and of course, it is the British who did it. I don't think there's much doubt in my mind about that. I mean, I think the British Special Forces were probably involved in the assassination of Zakhachenko, who was the Prime Minister, elected Prime Minister of the Donbass in 2018. It was a car bomb. That's got all the fingerprints of British Special Forces all over it. That's the sort of thing that they do. They even boast about it in their cups, that this is the sort of thing they do. And you can see people like Ben Wallace and others being rather proud that we're actually the cutting edge of all of this. I think the Russians are blaming us for two reasons. One is we did do it, and we did all of these things. The other thing is they're trying to do a deal with the Americans, and we could end up with a situation where the British take all the blame, and the Americans say, oh, my God, what were the British up to? We didn't know anything about that. And, of course, they're giving the Americans that option by blaming the British.
Yes, I suppose so. Divide and rule, something that we've been doing for a long, long time. Anyway, this whole Ukraine business came up at Prime Minister's Questions this week as well. So let's have a listen to the Ukraine question from Wednesday.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Given the continued Russian invasion and the now illegal annexation of parts of Ukraine, will the Prime Minister recommit his government to pursuing the full and proper accountability, including through the International Criminal Court, of those who violate international law in territories that they occupy? And in particular, will he pursue the rigorous application of the Fourth Geneva Convention in terms of the treatment of civilian populations in militarily occupied areas?
The honourable gentleman for his question, which is absolutely right. I can confirm we will continue with the policy that the previous government put in place, and I think it's something that we can be proud of, that we provided, I think, the earliest technical support to gather evidence to put cases together for future prosecutions at the ICC. We will continue to gather evidence, provide support to the Ukrainians, because he's absolutely right. What we are hearing is abhorrent, it's wrong, and those that who are conducting these things must be held to account.
Well, the question is, how much support are they providing to the Ukrainians? And does that include militarily attacking and assaulting Russian ships, particularly these ones last weekend in Sevastopol? Martin, what do you know what damage was done to the Russian fleet? You know, various ships put out of action or what? How successful?
Well, I mean, obviously, the Russians play their cards very close to the chest. They said we were attacked, but don't forget this is their main naval base. It's their equivalent of Portsmouth, so it's pretty well defended. And they're basically, if they can't fight off a drone attack, then they're not really capable of defending themselves.
And so yesterday, the British ambassador to Russia, Deborah Bronner, was summoned in to the embassy with a big protest outside, quite a big protest anyway. Russia protests to the British ambassador over the drone strike on Crimea. Crimea seems to be the sort of hinge point of a lot of this, doesn't it? That the idea really is that that the British are saying that Crimea is part of Ukraine. The Russian foreign ministry said on your Thursday it delivered a protest to the British ambassador, asking for explanations after summoning her to alleged involvement of British specialists in a Ukrainian drone strike on Russia's Black Sea fleet. I mean, let's bear in mind what Kim.com was saying about how much of a trace these sorts of operations electronically leave and how possible it is that the Russians have just been following that. The Chinese and many other intelligence agencies know about this. It's just the public that are being kept in the dark. The démarche stressed that such confrontational activities by the British threaten to escalate the situation, could lead to unpredictable and dangerous consequences, the ministry said in a statement. Now, unpredictable and dangerous consequences, this obviously includes now this nuclear threat, Martin, and it just seems like the British are poking the bear here for the Yanks.
Well, I mean, yes, that's obviously what's going on. Incidentally, when they mentioned about, you know, that people in occupation of, illegally in occupation of territories should be held to the full account of the law, I hope that includes all the Israeli general staff, the Saudi general staff, and the British who are embedded with the Saudi general staff that have invaded Yemen, and of course all the Indian people, military, that have been in occupation of Kashmir since 1947. And of course, when I was an aid worker in Yugoslavia and the ICC was set up, they tried to show that they were independent by arraigning people from all sides. So Croatians and Kosovans also were taken to the International Criminal Court and found guilty, because everybody in Yugoslavia did in fact engage in things which you could regard as being war crimes. But of course, the rest of the world just looks at this and goes, this is a joke. Because in actual fact, the US doesn't recognise the International Criminal Court, and when there has been attempts to try and make the Israelis brought to the International Criminal Court, John Bolton threatened the staff of the International Criminal Court that the US knew where their children lived. These are the kind of people we're dealing with, and yet they pontificate as if they are the morally righteous ones. It's quite clear that there have been atrocities on both sides in the Ukraine, and if we're going to be even-handed about it, then people on the Ukrainian side, including their British advisers, will have to stand trial as well. And if we're not doing that, then don't even talk about it. So it's just silly, isn't it?
I think that, to me, this is the big lesson of this week, is that I think Kim.com's done a fantastic job in just opening up this whole, I mean, basically it's like a theatre we're watching. So the intelligence services around the world, particularly the signals intelligence people, know exactly what's going on. The professional spooks are very much in cahoots, as we heard last week from Whitney Webb, with organised crime. And these people know exactly what's going on. It's just that they're not telling the public. They're not telling governments often. And so, in a way, this whole thing I was talking about earlier about the World Economic Forum, seeing these various national institutions crumble whilst organised crime and these supranational institutions like them are waiting in the wings, becomes, you know, even more pertinent. So, like, just to give them fair play to the Americans, let's have a listen now to David Petraeus. And I was going to use this. This is actually from last week, but I think it's fascinating to hear from the ex-CIA boss what he actually makes of what's going on, particularly with these nuclear threats. So let's start by hearing his take on the, you know, whether Putin is going to cross the nuclear threshold. Of course, he himself implies that the Americans would never do such a thing, you know, particularly in a false flag. He wouldn't say that, would he? But if there is some sort of nuke goes off, there is going to be immediate questions about identifying who's done it before the world's press or the Western press tell everyone, oh, this was Russia. So let's have a listen to Petraeus now, what he makes of the nuclear threshold.
I think it's unlikely at this point in time that he would cross the nuclear threshold. The U.S. and other countries' leaders have communicated very clearly, both privately and publicly, that the response to this would be, in the words of the U.S. National Security Advisor, catastrophic. That is very serious. He would, if he used nuclear weapons, dig a deeper hole for himself than that in which he is currently finding himself. He's in a terrible position. Essentially, over the past 8 months, Ukraine has built a bigger and more capable army on its soil than Russia has there, and there's really nothing that Putin can do about this. The referendum at gunpoint was just not relevant. The annexation has been meaningless. The martial law that he's now declared will be similarly meaningless. And the partial mobilization has reportedly prompted more Russian men to leave the country than to go to the conscription stations. And those that have shown up or have been dragooned by the conscription offices are not exactly fit, well-trained, and they won't be well-equipped either. So they're the definition of cannon fodder.
Okay.
Reality is that Russia has lost in 8 months more than three times what it lost in nine tough years in Afghanistan. So it's in a very difficult situation.
We'll get to the Russian position in just a bit, but I do want to press you on this issue, sir. I mean, in case Russia uses tactical nuclear weapons, you said that the senior the U.S. leadership has called it catastrophic. You said that it cannot go unanswered. And a hypothetical that you had put forward was that NATO taking out every conventional force on the battlefield. That doesn't necessarily mean nuke for nuke, does it?
Not at all. And again, all I was doing was providing one possible option that is in a range of options that undoubtedly has been developed for policymakers in Washington and in other capitals of close allies. And this would not necessarily be a NATO operation. This would probably be a U.S.-led multinational operation. This is not about a NATO country. There's no Article 5 collective self-defense action here. This would be a response to a horrific decision by the Russian leader to use nuclear weapons. And as the U.S. National Security Advisor has said, the response would be catastrophic. Now, he has publicly stated that he has communicated this to his counterparts in the Kremlin. Other leaders have done likewise, both publicly and privately. And again, there's just a range of options that would also certainly include more economic and financial and personal sanctions and export controls. There would be diplomatic initiatives and a host of other actions that would be in that range of options. Mm-hmm. One of those, as I mentioned, would be a conventional response led by the U.S. that could, again, dig that hole in which Russia finds itself even deeper by taking out Russian forces on Ukrainian soil and even perhaps taking out ships of the Black Sea Fleet as well.
So that's former CIA Director David Petraeus and Bilderberger, of course. Oh, and by the way, Charlie Skelton, our chum comedy writer and writer for The Guardian and various other publications, tweeted something this week that that Portugal is going to be the venue for the Bilderbergers in 2023. It's some front page of a Portuguese magazine says, oh, they've discovered where the venue is, which is great to think that there's other journalists these days keeping an eye on the Bilderbergers. But anyway, what do you make of that, Martin?
Well, I mean, it's delusionary to the point of insane. The idea that Russia is losing the war, I think Scott Ritter or Colonel Douglas McGregor, who are both ex-US forces, would just snort with derision at that. And the idea that this idea that the Putin, let's call it the Russian government, would use tactical nuclear weapons in Ukraine is wrong for two reasons. Firstly, the Russians don't believe in tactical nuclear weapons. Their nuclear weapons are designed to destroy the United States and Britain in one attack. They're not going to piddle around, dropping a small bomb. What the Russians accused the Ukrainians of doing last week is getting together a dirty bomb, which would use radioactive material that was blown up, and then they were going to blame that on the Russians and then call for an intervention by NATO of the kind that Petraeus was talking about at the end of that clip. Now, the Russian armed forces are not at all terrified of the British army turning up in the Ukraine. The British army is about a fraction of the size of the Ukrainian army, and it would last probably about a month before it was completely annihilated if they were sent to the front lines. The other reason why they're not going to use tactical nuclear weapons or any nuclear weapons in the Ukraine is because it's right next door to them. If they were going to carry out a nuclear attack, it would be on the United States of America. They wouldn't bother with nuking the Ukraine.
Is that what he means by unpredictable consequences?
Well, I mean, we all know this is a very dangerous situation.
When the British ambassador is called into the Russian foreign ministry in Moscow.
Yes, and I think there ought to be more of an understanding in this country of the absolutely insane policy being pursued across the political spectrum here, which is that we are going to go to war with Russia, but we're also going to, you know, have a prosperous future and our children are all going to go to university. Now, if we're going to go to war with the Russians, and it looks like we've gone to war with the Russians have certainly interpreted it like that. Don't forget, three civilians were killed in the attack on the Kerch Bridge, which the grey zone have shown that the British intelligence services are pushing an unconventional attack on the Kerch Bridge 6 months ago. Now, that is terrorism by any definition, and blowing up pipelines is an act of war.
No, I mean, I'd say it's an act of war. These things are...
Okay, civilians die in warfare. But of course, yeah. the people who gave the orders for that, they are war criminals because they knew and that civilians were going to die.
As far as I can see,
although warfare is warfare, understand I agree.
These things, well, it's understand these things that, that terrorism is a non, is generally seen as something done by non-state actors. Although, of course, you know, a large amount of terrorism is in fact state actors pretending not to be, and you know, as we've seen over the years with Operation Gladio, etc., etc., etc. But anyway, let's have a listen, because, I mean, there's been this raid on Nancy Pelosi's house, and I don't want to overblow it, because it looks almost to me as if it was, you know, choreographed to give Biden a nice excuse for a speech about how important democracy and how keen he is on preserving it over there. So let's have a listen now to the leader of the so-called free world, Joe Biden, giving a speech about how to preserve and protect democracy in the United States. And he, this is really, he's talking about a raid on the Speaker of the House of Representatives, I think she is, Nancy Pelosi, over there, where someone broke into her house. So let's have a listen to that now.
Good evening, everyone. Just a few days ago, a little before 2:30 a.m. in the morning, a man smashed the back windows and broke into the home of the Speaker of the House of Representatives, the third highest-ranking official in America. He carried in his backpack zip ties, duct tape, rope, and a hammer. As he told the police, he had come looking for Nancy Pelosi to take her hostage, to interrogate her, to threaten to break her kneecaps. But she wasn't there. Her husband, my friend Paul Pelosi, was home alone. The assailant tried to take Paul hostage. He woke him up. He wanted to tie him up. The assailant ended up using a hammer to smash Paul's skull. Thankfully, by the grace of God, Paul survived. All this happened after the assault. And it just, it's hard to even say. It's hard to even say. After the assailant entered the home asking, where's Nancy? Where's Nancy? Those are the very same words used by the mob when they stormed the United States Capitol on January the 6th, when they broke windows, kicked in the doors, brutally attacked law enforcement, roamed the corridors hunting for officials, and erected gallows to hang the former Vice President, Mike Pence. It was an enraged mob that had been whipped up into a frenzy by a president repeating over and over again the big lie that the election of 2020 had been stolen. It's a lie that fueled the dangerous rise in political violence and voter intimidation over the past 2 years. Even before January the 6th, we saw election officials and election workers in a number of states subject to menacing calls, physical threats, even threats to their very lives. In Georgia, for example, the Republican Secretary of State and his family were subjected to death threats because he refused to break the law and give in to the defeated president's demand, just find him 11,780 votes. Just find me 11,780 votes. Election workers like Shay Moss and her mother Ruby Freeman were harassed and threatened just because they had the courage to do their job and stand up for the truth, to stand up for our democracy. This institution, this intimidation, this violence against Democrats, Republicans, and nonpartisan officials just doing their jobs are the consequence of lies told for power and profit, lies of conspiracy and malice, lies repeated over and over to generate a cycle of anger, hate, vitriol, and even violence. In this moment, we have to confront those lies with the truth. The very future of our nation depends on it. My fellow Americans, we're facing a defining moment, an inflection point. We must, with one overwhelming, unified voice, speak as a country and say there's no place, no place for voter intimidation or political violence in America, whether it's directed at Democrats or Republicans. No place, period. No place ever. I speak today near Capitol Hill, near the U.S. Capitol, the citadel of our democracy. I know there's a lot at stake in these midterm elections, from our economy to the safety of our streets to our personal freedoms, the future of health care, Social Security, Medicare. It's all important. But we'll have our differences. We'll have our difference of opinion. And that's what it's supposed to be. But there's something else at stake. Democracy itself. I'm not the only one who sees it. Recent polls have shown that an overwhelming majority of Americans believe our democracy is at risk, that our democracy is under threat. They, too, see that democracy is on the ballot this year, and they're deeply concerned about it. So today, I appeal to all Americans, regardless of party, to meet this moment of national and generational importance. We must vote, knowing what's at stake and not just the policy of the moment, but institutions that have held us together as we sought a more perfect union are also at stake. We must vote knowing who we have been, what we're at risk of becoming. Look, my fellow Americans, the old expression, freedom is not free. It requires constant vigilance.
So Joe Biden speaking this week about the state of U.S. democracy. I wonder, I mean, he's saying that democracy is under threat. Is Joe Biden the guy to sort things out?
Well, obviously he's not on the ballot next week. It's elections to the Senate and the Congress. And, of course, it's not even full elections to the Senate and the Congress. I think they have partial elections. I'm not quite sure how it works. Well, that's very much he's trying to rally the Democrat base there. And, of course, it may well be that this incident is not what it seems. I hate to say this, but I don't trust anything they say about anything.
No.
I'm sorry.
Well, I know. Yeah.
I mean, on January the 6th itself, when, you know, the events of the storming of the Capitol building took place and so on, there were supposedly bombs planted outside both Democrats and Republican headquarters in the city, which were defused by the authorities. Now, given what we know about Operation Gladio, operation in Italy in the 70s and earlier, the idea that the deep state could be manipulating all of these things through the use of terrorism is quite straightforward. I mean, I said earlier in the show, and I say it week after week, anybody in the US who doesn't understand that your own security forces attacked you on the September the 11th, you've got to recognise that that's the defining moment. That's the moment at which the war dead of two world wars were disgraced. And of course, nobody in the mainstream here or there wants to face up to the fact about the warmongering deep state, which is actually, you know, behind a lot of so-called Islamist violence, etc.
Gladio point taken, but what about this satanic Gladio that I'll be hearing a little bit more about that in a minute, as I promised a few weeks ago, the Order of the Nine Angles. This is something that seems to be ongoing. The idea that there are groups out there that are literally have impunity. Amazingly, of course, the Order of the Nine Angles that's been conducting these terrorist attacks is based in the UK, still not banned by the Home Office. But anyway, on this old idea of Where's Nancy, you know, linking this attack to the storming of the Capitol, there is a big attempt in the United States to say that this was an attempt to take over the country, blah, blah, blah. And Don DeBar was on Press TV this week explaining why he thinks that's such a load of nonsense. He says there was never any real attempt to take over the country and that this is all just really a kind of judicial process in order to try to stop Donald Trump running in the next presidential election. So let's have a listen now to the Stop Trump angle on Press TV, which was reported this week, but pretty much nowhere else by Don DeBar and by the Iranians.
It's absurd to term this an insurrection and to certainly say that it was an intended coup d'etat. Let's say that this group of people led by the guy with the horns and whoever else was among their group were able to hold the Capitol building, say, for a month or a year. Does anyone imagine that they thought from there, using Pelosi's phone, they could call the Pentagon and order a drone strike, or they could call the Office of Budget Management and have someone budget something for them, a limousine or lunch or whatever, or that they could call IRS and have them issue a check to someone. What exactly was the mechanism that was going to be used to seize power besides occupying the Capitol building? It's not just irresponsible, it's almost infantile to refer to it this way. And I don't mean anything personal to Dan, but that to me, that doesn't make any sense at all. You can't think this thing one sentence forward and hold that that's what it was. Now, given that, the situation in this country is more or less a media show. These individual incidents are characterized across a broad, you know, basically a broad set of outputs that go into the brain of every person in the country, characterizing them in one fashion or another and inflaming these emotional, you know, reservoirs that exist among two groups of people who watch media either MSNBC style or Fox style, where this is stoked on a constant basis. The guy himself is clearly a lunatic, okay? They did a jailhouse interview with his wife, who was in prison for 20 years for trying to kidnap a 14-year-old boy. This guy, there's allegations of him molesting his children. She says that he thought he was Jesus Christ for 6 months or whatever. This is not a marker, I hope it's not a marker, of the body politic in the United States or of the followers or adherence to any particular political grouping in the United States. This is a nut job that got his hands on a hammer, and whether he was invited in by Paul Pelosi, which is also one of the sets of allegations out here that's, you know, unproven or not, or broke in through security. That how do you not have security for the person third in line for the presidency, where somebody can just bust in the house at 2 o'clock in the morning? Whatever that was, it's not an indication that there's a group of people that are looking to seize the government in the United States, and that we have to somehow legislate ourselves and what I hear Dan saying, maybe revise the Constitution in order to protect ourselves.
So that's Don DeBar there, an extract from the spotlight this week on Press TV, the Iranian channel, banned in the UK, banned in various other parts of the world. They just it's basically banned by the satellite companies. And then afterwards, Ofcom and various regulators say, oh, well, it's been banned. We better find an excuse to ban it. And that's the discussion you're not allowed to hear. So he's painting a picture there, Martin. I mean, I think particularly interesting is that there's a big deal being made of this, whereas there was actually really no reality of any kind of attempt to seize the government. But the more important point, in a way, is that much of the fuss is being made about people who are actually mentally ill and possibly could be being manipulated in the situations where they are very vulnerable people.
Well, that's what I would say. It's almost inconceivable that the third in line to the government would have such weak protection. And it seems to me that mentally ill people are part of the Gladio-style methodology. These are exactly the kind of people who can be... They are the patsies. There's the patsies, there's the technicians, and there are the moles that actually are behind all of this stuff. And, you know, that was a fair summary of what's going on. Keeping the US public in two hostile camps, all of whom, of course, are absolutely in favour of the State of Israel, all of whom support the war in the Ukraine, although the progressive caucus in the US, in Congress, 30 of them signed a very wimpy letter saying, why don't we think about having a peace conference, you know, some kind of peace deal, and then they withdrew it. And what you've got is the fomentation by the deep state in the West of societal fracture. So they're running both the Islamist groups like Al-Majahroon here, and they're also running these extreme fascist groups who actually hate Muslims. They've infiltrated all of them, and they could say, well, we've got to infiltrate everything, that's why we're keeping you safe. But they're not just infiltrating them, they're creating these conflicts, and then they are the deep state is continuing its drive to dominate the planet on the back of that.
Well, I mean, I wonder if there's a similar relationship between the energy industry and the Extinction Rebellion, because it does seem to me that the prescription that Greta Thunberg, an ex of, and the COP summit is putting for the world could actually make a Well, it looks to me as if it's going to be a bigger crisis than the crisis that they're saying that they're trying to solve. So there's something quite perverse about that. Anyway, let's have a listen now, as I promised, to Whitney Webb. Whilst we're on this topic of kind of manipulation, so we had quite a long clip from her. This is a shorter one this week. We had quite a long clip last week. Her book is out for Christmas, and it's called One Nation Under Blackmail. In fact, I think it's two books you have to buy separately or together, Volume 1 and Volume 2. And in the interview that she did for the Financial Rebellion podcast, she talks about... this Palantir software. Now, this is a bit of software which has been invented by the Central Intelligence Agency and commissioned by them initially. Bilderberg is very much involved in all that. And the idea is that it enables you to completely watch all your population, you're profiling everybody, and you can then see if you want a particular social outcome, you can ask the software to bring you up the people that you need to target, and then you can target them. So it is a kind of almost like a desktop control your population piece of software. Anyway, let's let Whitney Webb explain a bit about why she thinks this is a fascinating topic, which she talks about in her book.
Palantir is something that I've written a lot about. It's basically the privatized version of a program DARPA was trying to run after 9/11 called Total Information Awareness. And even that was part of a much older agenda that goes back to the Iran-Contra era and continuity of government protocols, and basically an effort to have a massive database of domestic dissidents in the United States who could be rounded up, detained in the event of some sort of vaguely defined national emergency that, as they described as threatening continuity of government, i.e. the existing power structure, whatever that means. So, that database still exists, at least of, as of 2010 or so. And there's no reason to believe they got rid of it. And basically the way for them to organize and access that information, and basically turn all that, masses of those massive data troves into actionable intelligence is Palantir. So Palantir is obviously a very concerning company because from the very beginning they were set up to basically be a CIA front. What I see as particularly concerning is that the person who's behind it, who's a man named Peter Thiel, has basically marketed himself as, sort of like a Trump type of supporter guy, and has backed a lot of sites that people are using now in favor of big tech alternatives, in favor of big tech companies. So like Rumble, for example, an alternative to YouTube, is backed by this guy. But he's made the CIA's data mining software that's made to, exist to profile people they want to label domestic terrorists. So isn't it convenient that the very group they're labeling domestic terrorists are now using all these platforms funded by the guy that literally made that software? And it's disconcerting.
Whitney, going back to Rumble, are you saying Rumble's run by someone? Because I knew Rumble was bad.
It's funded by Peter Thiel. I forget exactly through which vehicle, but he funds a lot of people in independent media, particularly those that lean right. And he also funds a lot of these platforms. I personally suspect that a lot of it's just to get, access to the data. And I think Elon Musk taking over Twitter is going to be part of that as well. I have some concerns about that because I don't think a lot of people have really been honest about the history of those people and their connections to like this network and the people that are interested in, basically having a war on domestic terror that's really a war on domestic dissent, which is what the war on domestic terror is designed to be. Right. So it's very concerning. To me that people, are acting like this guy, Peter Thiel or Elon Musk, are here to like save the day. But at the end of the day, these are people with very deep connections to intelligence. You look at someone like Elon Musk. He's a contractor for an intelligence agency in the military through SpaceX and stuff. It is that should be talked about in terms of his Twitter acquisition. But it's not. It's been kind of left out of the narrative. And the same thing with Peter Thiel. Palantir was funded with InQtel money, which is the CIA's venture capital firm. The CIA basically designed their product and the CIA was their only client for their first 3 years as a business. Now, all seven, well, I guess it's 18 now with Space Force. All 18 U.S. intelligence agencies use Palantir. The FBI uses it. I mean, they all use it. And so Palantir is basically, it's basically the successor to the Promise software, if you're familiar with that, which is from the 1980s, which was basically used to track stuff, whether it's money flows or people. And so Palantir has two types. I forget the names right now. One of them's called Gotham, and that's like the corporate one. And then there's the one that's used by governments. And it's basically the same thing. Throughout the whole Promise scandal, they were looking for different ways to get around litigation with the fact the U.S. government basically stole that software and violated a contract with the people that originally created it. And so they tried and argue like, oh, we've modified it so much, it's nothing like the original that we stole now. And they couldn't only do that for so long. So I think eventually they tried to basically take the same software and disguise it as a product that was created by an unrelated company so they could sort of get out of the issue with the litigation they were having over the Promise software. So Palantir is basically like that, but supercharged. And one of the guys that was involved with the Iran-Contra domestic dissidents list and surveillance, John Poindexter, was one of the key people involved in helping set up Palantir. And he was going to run Total Information Awareness. I mean, it's just a really crazy story. But Facebook, the origins of Facebook are part of that same story. Peter Thiel is the guy that put Facebook on the map at the same time he was trying to resurrect Total Information Awareness as Palantir. And at the same time, DARPA had another program that was being axed called LifeLog, which is essentially analogous to what Facebook is. So it's just a way to get people to voluntarily hand over their data so you can profile them and decide if you want to keep them around or not.
Whitney Webb, the great, the one and only. Her book is One Nation Under Blackmail. Martin, I love her expression there, the war on terrorism, which is actually really just a war on dissent.
Well, that's been pretty clear, hasn't it, from the get-go. It's not just a question of surveying the population, though, is it? They actually carry out grotesque acts of violence are at the heart of all of this, including the 9/11 attacks and quite a lot of the other attacks that we've been subjected to. And it's a very dangerous time. The problem from their point of view is that by this stage of World War III, Iran should have been knocked down, Russia should have been subdued, and China should be being surrounded. But unfortunately, from their point of view, none of that has happened.
I think that actually what's been going on is there's been an attempt to set the Chinese against the Americans, so that there have been attempts to make China stronger. In fact, just as there have been attempts to make Iran stronger, so that there is
who's making Iran stronger in America?
Martin, a conflict with Russia in the future. A conflict between, it seems to me, both Iran and Israel are being built up by various sides around the world, and China and America, in order to create future conflicts, no?
No, I think you're missing the basic point. There is not just one centre of power. There isn't. Pfizer doesn't control the decisions of the Chinese Communist Party. The Russians and the Russians were under the thumb.
I'm not saying there's only one centre of power. I'm saying that there, over the decades, actually, there have been attempts to set up these conflicting relationships, such as the Iran-Israel relationship and the America-China relationship. And this is basically organised crime. I mean, this is why this sort of ties back to Whitney Webb. In that, much of her work has been on looking at the way organised crime actually really works today. So, no, you don't think that's the case?
No, I don't, Tony. I think there's a whole lot of historical evidence that shows that the Western powers, what they thought that by bringing the Chinese into the World Trade Organization, they would help to empower a faction of the Chinese Communist Party, or the Communist Party of China, to give its official title, which would open up the banking system and all the rest of it to Western financial interests. It didn't play out that way.
If the Americans are really totally opposed to China,
they're not totally opposed to it.
Deep state in the United States. Why is it that they're hiring out their satellites to the Chinese to suppress and oppress their population?
There are elements of the Chinese economy since 2000 has become deeply enmeshed with the US economy. Walmart survives on bringing in cheap Chinese stuff and knocking it out to people on very low wages in the United States, and they can still have a reasonable standard of living because the prices are so low.
And do you think that, you know, to a certain extent, the authoritarians in both these countries have got things in common?
Of course they have, because what happens in wartime is the authoritarians on both sides get power because war is an authoritarian thing. That doesn't mean they're on the same side. It just means they're copying each other's behaviour, because if you're in a war, that's what you do.
There seems to be a lot of technology exchange and a certain amount of collusion. Look, can we just move on? Because we're getting towards the end now. I'd just like to play this clip, because we mentioned Vice with Joe Banks earlier on, which he used to write for and has done quite a bit for in the past. And they did an amazing series. I could not find out when this was actually published. Maybe one of our listeners can help to find out when this actually came out, nor the name of the journalist, because it's not on the piece itself. But it's an absolutely fascinating look at the Freemasons and the Mafia. So the idea of organized crime working very closely with Freemasonry. I suppose this is really what we're talking about here, is interlocking cults. So a religious cult, a criminal cult, well, they may have things in common. They may be able to work together. Let's have a listen to that now.
Why mafia goes on and on? Because mafia is something rooted in society. The mafia is infiltrating the economy, business.
November 2021. Italian law enforcement were jubilant, for good reason. Over 100 arrests had been made across the country, targeting the Calabrian 'Ndrangheta, one of the most powerful mafia groups in the world, responsible for untold violence and worth tens of billions of dollars. Amongst the property seizures and dizzyingly large cocaine busts, a few strange details went under the radar. For one, how a batch of coke that had made its way from South America was stamped with a logo featuring an eye and a compass, the universally known symbol of Freemasonry. It wasn't a one-off. Further packets revealed the same symbol alongside the Greek letter Alpha and Omega. For some, it sparked concern about an increasing coziness between mob bosses and Masonic lodges across southern Italy, with their alleged rogues gallery of corrupt senior police officers, grasping politicians and local business elites. Just how deep does it go? Welcome to the business of crime. In this episode, we're going to be taking a closer look at the alleged links between Italian mafia groups and the country's Masonic lodges, a connection that has a long, if not always entirely clear-cut, history. Few organizations have captured public imagination and suspicion over the years quite like the Freemasons. With their secrecy, obscure membership criteria, and long history of suspected corruption, they're a group, it's safe to say, that have attracted their fair share of mistrust. Globally, it's estimated there are around 6 million Freemasons, with a particularly strong presence in the UK, US, and Italy. Though things aren't quite as mysterious as they once were about the group's inner workings, it's still an organization with significant secrets.
We have to keep in mind that the Freemasonry and the Mafia have many things in common. Both organizations, for example, share values of humility. They share the respect for rules, the respect for the hierarchy. Like Freemasonry, the Mafia has initiation rituals and rules of behavior rooted in secrecy.
In Italy, the bond between Freemasonry and Mafia groups in the South has a long, complicated history. There are superficially shared values. Both were heavily repressed between the 1920s until the end of World War II as potential threats to the power of Mussolini's fascist state. And both have a long, contentious relationship with the pillars of Italian political and commercial society, one where rumors of collusion and corruption are never too far from the surface.
The fact that the 'Ndrangheta is well connected and deeply rooted in this society, with connection to politicians, businessmen, police officers, magistrates, judges, and that's its the strain of the Mafia.
In a wiretapped conversation in 2013, one 'Ndrangheta boss Pantaleone Mancuso summed up the relationship. The 'Ndrangheta is no longer, he said. The Freemasons remain. In 2017, a series of police raids discovered 193 high-ranking members of the Sicilian Mafia and the Calabrian 'Ndrangheta to be members of lodges across the south. According to the work of dogged prosecutors and the testimony of mob turncoats, the secrecy of Masonic lodges provided the perfect place to conduct shady deals with figures from the business and political elite. Later, a series of local lodges in Calabria were dissolved after discovery of mobsters on their books. One case which has become infamous is that of Giovanni Zumbo. A well-respected Calabrian accountant, he had made a name for himself, managing properties seized from organized crime on behalf of the courts. But Zumbo was later convicted of mafia crimes after law enforcement discovered that he had been tipping off one notorious local boss about a looming arrest.
We have this guy, an accountant, that goes to Pelle, one of the biggest godfather of 'Ndrangheta, while he was on the run. He goes there and tells to the man, there are the recordings of this, telling, be careful, they are going to arrest you, they are going to make a big operation a week before, and giving also the exact numbers of people that they are going to be arrested. When he's going to arrest it himself.
How could an accountant get inside information about a sensitive police operation? Turns out one of his fellow Masons was a senior police officer on the same force. This is, critics allege, how the relationship works. Lodges are a connecting bridge between organized crime and the state. In late 2021, Masons in Rome won a landmark case that they say poured cold water on years of persistent accusations. It started with Stefano Bisi, Grand Master of Italy's biggest lodge, La Grande Oriente Italia, which has over 23,000 members. In 2017, he labelled the sweeping investigation into mob Mason ties an anti-democratic witch hunt. After being slapped with a defamation lawsuit by the prosecution, the case was thrown out by a judge.
In this case, for example, Bisi, that is the Grand Maestro della Grande Loggia d'Oriente in Italia, he expelled Pitelli immediately. And he said, you see, I cannot control everyone, but I did move him out as soon as I got to know the situation.
What really hurt, BC said, was the blow to its reputational prestige, in that it prompted the United Grand Lodge of England to formally distance itself from the Grand Oriente. After all, he said, 193 cases from thousands of members hardly spelled a crisis, a spirited bad apple defense of the Italian Masonic fraternity. Giancarlo Pitelli was a defendant at last year's so-called mega trial of 355 Ndrangheta suspects held in a former call center in a dingy Calabrian industrial estate.
I'm sure that this guy, this man, he is dangerous, in my opinion. He is this lawyer. At the moment, he was arrested and still under investigation. That was arrested because he was the lawyer of important godfathers.
Cases like Pitelli's make the complexity clear. Are the 'Ndrangheta and other mafia groups deeply embedded within the contemporary Italian Freemasons? Or is it really the case of a few lone chancers opportunistically picking up whatever crumb they can?
Questo processo dà la possibilità di spiegare come l'Ndrangheta sia in relazione con pezzi delle istituzioni, con pezzi della classe dirigente.
Freemasonry may help the 'Ndrangheta to succeed, and sometimes they invented deviated lodge or some connection, or they are involved in with members associated to some lodges. But that doesn't mean that the whole lodges are corrupted or infiltrated by the 'Ndrangheta or a mafia-like criminal organization.
It's just around the money and power. So it's something, you know, because the people think, why we never defeat mafia? we will never defeat, because it's really good and evil, the eternal fight.
Either way, the potential significance of Masonic iconography on intercepted drug shipments maybe shouldn't be overstated. After all, branding is important, even to sinister transnational criminal organizations like the 'Ndrangheta. Symbols come and go, whatever the depth of the links between the organizations. The eye and compass might not be an unsubtle clue, but simply a way to make the shipment stand out, a piece of self-aware marketing. Things aren't always a code to be cracked, however tempting it may be to think so. But if nothing else, there is one link between Masons and Mafia. Their own fraternal codes are the reason they've lasted so long, and it may be the thing that helps them endure.
So, terrific report from Vice there. Dating it is, like I say, there's no date on the report itself, but it's clearly this year. The big trial she's talking about was last year. She talks about it as last year in that report. And I think, you know, that's, it's actually very balanced and fair for them to say, well, you know, the fact that these shipments of cocaine were marked with these Masonic symbols doesn't necessarily mean that Freemasonry is involved. But quite clearly, these codes of secrecies, the oaths that they swear to be loyal to their craft or to forfeit their own lives, Martin, are quite similar between the Mafia and the Masons. And, you know, in Italy, of course, it was Mazzini that formulated the Casa Nostra that was part of the unification of the country. And we've talked quite a lot of times about his alleged letter that he got sent by Albert Pike in the United States, which were all really to do with creating conflict in order to, you know, in order to centralize power, for them to basically kick out Judeo-Christianity from the planet, that some people allege was part of Hitler's plan. But anyway, getting back to the Masons and the Mafia, too many similarities for this just to be coincidence, isn't it, really?
Well, I think it's pretty well known. I mean, when you mentioned Mazzini and La Cosa Nostra there, Mazzini's organization was called the Carbonari, which is a different setup. The Freemasons in Europe in the 18th and 19th centuries were the radical bourgeoisie, if you like, and the secrecy is because in a repressive society, that secrecy is necessary if you're going to, you know, overthrow the system. So they had a radical history. So Freemasonry was banned in Franco Spain and in Mussolini's Italy because it was seen to have slightly, you know, left of centre orientation.
No. Hang on. I mean, we had this discussion with Jack Lopresti, the Freemason MP in Bristol. And the actual reason was that if you're running, you know, an organisation like they were, they don't want these secret societies around. They realise they're powerful. Hitler banned them too.
Yes.
You know, in fact, what he had was the SS, which was a much more powerful cult. They don't want these little silly cults running around.
Well, exactly. Well, the point is then, Tony, that various organisations have the similar structures, hierarchical secret structures, are actually the bread and butter, the sinews of any kind of militant organisation, whatever it is. That's why warfare is such an authoritarian thing.
Yeah, I mean, I
think, you know, because that's it forces this stuff on you.
The Tolpapel martyrs were convicted for. Actually, what was going on all the time in Freemasonry at the time was completely the same, but they weren't convicted. The Tolpanel martyrs were.
Well, that's right. I mean, they were convicted of swearing unlawful oaths, whereas of course others who swore oaths to, you know, whatever it might be, you know, the organisations of
government, basically government approved oaths.
Yes. Now, coming back to Italy in specifics. It's quite clear, anybody who's looks into the history of Italy in the 70s and 80s and Gladio and all the rest of it, there's a brilliant film that came out in 2016, I think, which is in Italian. I can't remember the title of it. I think it's called, I can't remember it, but it's about the Piazza Fontana bombing in 1969, which kicked off the whole of the Gladio cycle. The Freemasons brought together the elite of the society in the Propaganda Due, the Freemasons' lodge, and they were linked to the Mafia. No doubt about it, Mafia-Freemason links. It's not just because they've got the same kind of basic structure. It's because they were melded together. And what melded them together was the Western Intelligence Services, the OSS, the CIA, MI6, which, of course, wasn't mentioned in any of that little report. Because, of course, underlying all of this is the states the state uses these mechanisms, the deep state, to control the society.
Well, yeah, I mean, you could also say that these cults and secret societies use the state, Martin, couldn't you?
You could. And in actual fact, what happens is there is a melding of resources and personnel. Licio Gelli, who was behind all of the main man behind P2, he had actually been a major person in Mussolini's setup, even though Mussolini himself was hostile to the Freemasons. And of course, people like Gelli can become a fascist, then they become a Freemason, then they're linked to the mafia and are actually run by the CIA and MI6. And of course, in this murky world, people are double, treble, quadruple agents. And underlying all of this, it's more complicated. And then, of course, there are other things. You know, the triads are big in China, but they're not the Italian mafia and they're not the Communist Party of China, although they will be trying to infiltrate it, of course.
Isn't these secret groups' interests to have tentative links at the top? Anyhow, let's move to our final item now, which is looking at the Order of the Nine Angles again. We had a clip a few weeks ago from this terrific military podcast, which I'd not come across before, called Popular Front. The host is Jake Hanrahan, and this week we're going to hear an extract from number 71 of their Popular Front podcast, where he talks to British journalist Daniel De Simone about this Order of the Nine Angles. Now, extraordinarily, Order of the Nine Angles has been endorsed, according to David Livingstone, by one of the great, big inverted commas, great accelerationist ideologues, Nick Land, this guy I was at school with as a teenager, bizarrely. But this whole idea really is about the rising and the spread of Britain's occultist militant group. That's what he calls it. But Daniel De Simone, as a UK, I mean, the most shocking thing, shocking, shouldn't use that word, but it is that this satanic, and this is the second time we've been talking about Satanists this week, and a lot of people think, oh, this is all just silly stuff, but it certainly isn't. It is the way that, although this is a terrorist organisation, organised terrorist attacks, planned terrorist attacks, etc., it still hasn't been banned by the Home Office. So one wonders if maybe, you know, the Order of the Nine Angles has got its people at the Home Office making sure that it isn't banned. So let's have a listen to Popular Front, an extract from that. Jake Hanrahan interviewing Daniel De Simone now.
They have a supernatural belief system. It is different from some of the more recognisable kind of, if you like, Satanist groups like the Church of Satan, which, as you said before, is almost like edgy atheism. It's about self-gratification. It's about, they would see it as rationalism. It's about kind of self-advancement and celebration of selfishness. What Order of Nine Angles would say is that they're not, those people aren't real Satanists. That kind of real Satanism is about, you know, practical acts. It's about real evil, and it isn't about just showing off and having some, you know, big party where everyone's dressed in silly clothes. It's about actually getting your hands dirty, and they would then, there's sort of various levels, there's a hierarchy, if you like, within the organisation that people are meant to kind of advance through. It's like a sevenfold way, so there's sort of seven levels, and people would sort of move through them, and actually, by their own account, very, very few people reach the kind of the top level, as like an immortal, you know. So people would be encouraged to, first of all, study and read the texts, and, you know, this can be something that people do on their own. You know, there isn't necessarily a formal instructional process going on where someone's telling someone else. Then people, you know, are basically at a certain point in it, people are encouraged to actually create their own nexium, you know, what they call like their own order, their own little group. And because people are basically being encouraged to influence others, manipulate others, and sort of prove themselves in doing that. So that's why you often get these different kind of groups affiliated sort of orders and Nexions cropping up, that some of them are a bit visible because they have like an online presence. And you see them around the world, some of them in the UK, some of them in the US. And this is almost really an inevitable part of it, because they're actually encouraging people to create their own groups as part of their progression. People are also encouraged to what they call engage in insight roles. So people are encouraged to infiltrate often political organisations, religious organisations, to try and then manipulate those groups towards kind of the ends of the order. So you've seen people becoming involved in political, like neo-Nazi groups. There's some evidence that certainly people in the UK have infiltrated non-mainstream Christian churches, which they've then boasted about doing to people they're close to. And really, the kind of the idea underlying all this is that people are, they're trying to kind of act as a gateway into this realm, like the, what we would see as the world, for kind of evil forces, for kind of to turn history towards where they want it to go to. That's sort of what they're doing. So they're trying to disrupt and undermine what they see as a deeply flawed civilization. That's what they want to do. And obviously they would then claim credit probably in their own heads for things that go wrong. But obviously I think you and I can probably just understand that, you know, these people really aren't as influential as they like to imagine. I think that the threat that they pose is that they influence often quite impressionable people who then potentially engage in violent activity or sexual violence. I suppose one of the things is that if people are encouraged to engage in criminality or acts of harm to undermine society, that could be totally random. You know, there may be crimes that have been committed by people who are involved with this group that will never really be obviously linked to this group, or they'll, on the face of it, be no motive. Because obviously at the most sensational end, this group, some of their texts encourage people to engage in human sacrifice, and then, you know, whether or not that actually happens or not, this is the sort of thing that it's saying in the text.
They even use the German word, right? They call them Opfers, like offerings or something.
Yeah, they do, yeah. And they, you know, they've got there's texts which set out rituals. You know, there's this book called Black Book of Satan, which sets out rituals, often like Black Mass, which is an inversion of the Christian Mass. And these sort of rituals are often, you know, very kind of clearly sexually charged, which is the same as the Black Mass. It's meant to be pushing against kind of the Christian rituals. And within that, yes, there are descriptions of human sacrifice and so on. Whether or not that's real or not, that's what they say in the text. So it's pretty unpleasant. And I think when people see all this and they hear all this, I think obviously the first probably reaction of a lot of people is to think, oh, this is all just ridiculous and it's just a lot of nonsense and that we shouldn't take it seriously. But I think that unfortunately once it's starting to seep into terrorism cases and it's clearly influencing some quite dangerous people, then I think it should be a concern. I don't think we should overstate their importance. You know, they are still a small group. There are a few of these people who are quite open in some ways online. They publish blogs. They publish sometimes pictures about what they're up to. They don't reveal who they are, but they're kind of promoting themselves. I just think it. I wouldn't have really taken it that seriously, you know, probably 3 or 4 years ago. But I've sort of tended to take it more seriously since then.
So that's Daniel de Simon on the Popular Front podcast with Jake Hanrahan. I'll put a link up to the complete version of that. It's nearly an hour. He's talking about the Order of the Nine Angles there. I suppose the obvious thing here, Martin, is, you know, this is something which is, it seems very dark, it's very mysterious, it's almost like a kind of horror story. But what we're seeing is, you know, for example, the massacre of 50 people here in New Zealand in Christchurch, the guy who did it, Brenton Tarrant, who's now in jail, he had these kind of satanic symbols, the black sun, etc., all over his gun, written on his bag, talking about the satanic stuff in his manifesto. That's just one example, quite an important one, of a mission here to, you know, they're obviously on a mission to do something. In that case, it was just to massacre a whole load of Muslims in New Zealand, imagine, in order to try to get Muslims to be recruited to ISIS or something and wish to fight back. But anyway, to set Muslims against, you know, maybe Christians or other parts of the civilization. There's definitely a mission that they're on here, and they're very real. They're extremely dangerous, the Order of the Nine Angles.
Well, I wouldn't dispute that, but I would suggest that they're also possibly the creatures of intelligence services. Like the guy who carried out the massacre in the mosque had been all over the world, and he's probably basically a patsy for forces bigger than himself, like Breivik in Norway.
Well, I mean, the other incredible thing about Christchurch, if I can just dwell on that a minute, because it clearly has got all the symbols that he's just been talking about there written all over this case, is the suppression of the video, which is obviously pretty hideous. I had a copy. But going through it, you can see that he appears to have had help with these various figures dressed in red, directing him around the mosque, towards the mosque, telling him when to get started and this sort of thing. It's quite clearly a military-style operation.
More significant than the particular ideology which he openly espoused. He possibly doesn't even realise who's really pulling his own strings. Just like the guy who broke into Nancy Pelosi's house, or many of the people who've been convicted of terrorism in the United States, Muslims mainly, who have been just set up by the FBI.
Anders Breivik over in Norway, he was a Freemason too, you know, so there are these sorts of connections are pretty enormous, I think. Anyway, why is it you think that the Order of the Nine Angles hasn't been proscribed by the Home Office? Do you think maybe, I mean, you're talking about the intelligence services, possibly MI5 within the Home Office has been infiltrated by the organisation of by the Order of the Nine Angles too, or else maybe the other way around. The Order of the Nine Angles is a creature of MI5.
Well, that's more likely, in my view. Like Al-Maji Harun on the Islamist side. And, the Ulster Defence Association was never banned by the British government, even though the Provisional IRA was banned. These things just depend upon the politics, don't they? Are we coming to an end, Tony? Because I just want to mention something slightly off.
Yeah, go for it. Yeah,
just want to mention this week that people need to be aware of is that the head of the National Union of Students has been the elected head of the National Union of Students in this country, whose name I cannot remember off the top of my head because I haven't got it written down. She has been removed. She is a black Muslim woman who used to be head of the NUS at City University in London, and she has been removed. Legally removed on the basis that she is an anti-Semite, because the Union of Jewish Students have accused her of that. And even though she's the elected head of the British National Union of Students, she's been removed from her position this week. Various pro-Palestinian groups have already spoken out against it. But it is quite extraordinary that the first black Muslim woman to run to be the head of the NUS has had her career supposedly ended because of anti-Semitism. Wow.
Well, I don't know if it's ended because there may be legal action, but of course...
She's taking legal action, yeah.
You're absolutely right.
As well she might.
It's Shaima Dalali, I think that's how you pronounce it.
That's right,
Shaima
yeah.
Dalali is considering all available legal remedies. Well, this is the Zionist lobby in the UK. Also worth mentioning, we're obviously following that, but also worth mentioning the attempt to kill Imran Khan this week, Martin.
Yes. Well, I mean, obviously, we were talking with Farouk Sadiq last week about this, and he said something like this is likely to happen, and now we see it. I mean, if you've got charismatic leaders like Khan, it's obvious for their enemies to kill them because they can't easily be replaced, like Hugo Chavez in Venezuela.
I mean, another sort of
Maduro
last
is a good, but he's nothing like as powerful in terms of charisma as Chavez was.
And another last minute item, the United Nations General Assembly this week has voted for Israel to get rid of its nuclear arsenal. So it seems apparently, despite their refusal to admit that they've got it, the United Nations has rumbled them. That's the General Assembly saying that...
You can be quite sure that the British and the Americans have vetoed any chance of that. This is the way the world works, isn't it?
Well, it certainly seems to be. I'll try next week. I'm going to do my best to do some stuff about New Zealand, a bit about the Moriori's, who apparently were here before the Maoris, the lack of popularity amongst some people, anyway, of the leader Jacinda Ardern, a bit about just what life is like here, going back to the 1960s when some of the first people arrived in Coromandel to colonize it, I suppose, and the fact that now there's so many more people here, it's actually very relatively, I mean, the road to where we're staying was only built in the 1960s. Apparently before that you had to get all the way around the coast by boat, and that was the only way to do it. So, and also I'd like to be looking, I hope hopefully next week, at a bit more to do with this Holland style protest that the New Zealand farmers are having to go through here with the left-wing government imposing all these what they call the burp tax and the fart tax on the farmers, basically saying you're going to have to stop having livestock. Well, I mean, it seems amazing to me that the New Zealand lamb and New Zealand beef is going to be stopped, apparently, or massively. Anyway, the farmers are up in arms about it. I'm going to see if I can find out a little bit more for next week's show. Time to sign off now. Thanks very much to our guest, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers, also Joe Banks, we heard at the beginning of the show. And also to sound engineer Dave Bazanko. Do please send me interviews and story tips via Not the BCFM Politics Show page, where you'll also find the podcast, full-length interviews. You can download it nice and easily and listen in the car or anywhere you like. And subscribe to my weekly email list if you like. Even donate at thisweekoneword.org.uk. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling. My paperbacks you can get hold of through Bilderberg.org, at least at some point, because as I'm out of the UK, I can't really post them out at the moment. But you can email me and ask, or even send in a check to the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, and I'll get that when I get home. So anyway, thank you for turning off the psycho in the corner. Thanks also to RadioQUK.com in Camberley, Surrey. And it's just about time to wind up now. Thank you to everybody that's been sending story links in for this week. Do please have a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. If you haven't already, check out the apps on the Apple App Store and elsewhere on the internet for your phone, which will ping you apparently when the show's about to start. And also you can listen to stuff on there easier in the car, isn't it, with Bluetooth or whatever. Have a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for Not the BCFM Politics Show live stream on talkradio.org.uk at 5 o'clock next Friday. That's the stream. The show is thisweek.org.uk. God bless. And don't let the Illuminati banksters get you down.
It's all a matter of time. I will not worry for you. You'll be just fine. Take my thoughts with you, and when you look behind, you will surely see a face that you recognize. You're not alone. I'll wait till the end of time. Surely it's plain to see you're not alone. I'll wait till the end of time for you. Open your mind. Surely there's time.